indicating that if she was sucking on, you know, a mint or something, it was meant no disrespect. And I couldn't help but think Charlie Zelli and I were at a, Commissioner Zelli, I'm sorry, were at a meeting yesterday or 2 days ago at the Swedish Embassy in downtown Minneapolis. It was kind of a big deal. And, you know, the ambassador to the U.S. from Sweden happens to be there. And I suppose like the Norwegians in the crowd would say, so big deal, right? However, I got hit with allergies. And as I'm talking, trying to be cool, all of a sudden everything broke loose and just kind of went like this. And the next thing you know, my nose is running. And tears are coming out of my eyes, and I reach for my hanky, and it's gone. So it was not
to the podium.
It was not a pretty sight. Yeah, yeah. So I had a staff member come running up with a pack of Kleenex. So we hope that doesn't happen today. Anyway, it was one of those deals that you probably would have had to have been there to really appreciate it.
You did a masterful job.
I'm sort of glad I wasn't there.
Yes, it was not a pretty sight, Tom. Yeah, yeah. Well, we have a busy agenda this afternoon, and so I'd like to start with some introductions, and then we'll move directly to the adoption of the consent agenda following that. Commissioner?
Charlie Zelli, Commissioner of MnDOT.
Spencer Cron, Commissioner of Administration.
Katie Clark-Sieben, Commissioner of Deed.
Kristen Idy Tollefson, citizen member from Southeast Minnesota.
Julie Gehring, citizen member from Moorhead.
Will Seifert, executive director.
Dave Fredrickson, agriculture.
Leah Hedman, assistant attorney general, representing the EQB board.
Tom Landwehr, commissioner of natural resources.
Sandy Rummel, metropolitan council.
Brian Napstad, chairman of the board of water and soil resources.
John Linkstein, commissioner of the pollution control agency.
John Saxhog, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Kate Knuth, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Mike Rothman, Commerce Commissioner.
Eric Tomlinson, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Thank you. You've seen the agenda and have also seen the minutes. They were sent to you. Could I have a motion
to approve?
So moved. There is a motion to approve the consent agenda. Is second. There a second? There is a second. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. I'm just going to skip over the chair's report at this time and go directly to the executive director's report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple brief updates since we last met in Rochester in March. Lots been going on over the past 2 months. Belated thanks to those who were able to make the trip in March. The silica sand rulemaking advisory panel continues to meet monthly, most recently to discuss reclamation requirements on Friday, May 16th. In Aronico, as a reminder, the EQB rulemaking will address environmental review thresholds for silica sand mining, storage, and processing. A draft rule and a statement of needs and reasonableness will come before the board later this year, pending the progress made with the panel. The Climate Change Subcommittee met on March 28th to discuss various policy options for consideration in the Climate Strategies and Economic Opportunities Analysis, also known as CZO. As a reminder, CZO will analyze the greenhouse gas reduction potential costs and job impacts for a wide variety of policy options that have been suggested by stakeholders and interagency experts. Intensive interagency work has ensued, and progress is being made on this project, as well as editing of the framework report, which is on schedule for your review by the next meeting in June. The National Governors Association Clean Energy and Economic Development Project has also been moving forward, most recently with a stakeholder meeting this morning and a multi-state policy academy in Phoenix last week. The governor is tentatively scheduled to host a summit on July 17th with broad industry and stakeholder participation. I strongly encourage all of you to attend if you are able. Details will follow. As a reminder, this project will produce a detailed report of our clean energy sector, building off of a robust industry engagement effort led by Deed and Commerce and a dedicated team of interagency staff. EQB is a partner in this effort. Our next meeting will include detailed presentations and status updates on the various climate and clean energy initiatives I just mentioned. With respect to our website, I understand there's a broad interest in the status of our website. We're working closely with the IT team at MPCA to move onto a new content management system to make web development and management easier and more self-sustaining. Since this is a new system we'll be utilizing, our timeline is a little uncertain, but we expect to complete the migration in August. Once this migration is complete, we can begin to retool our website. Our goal is to use our website to better engage the public and local governments on our key programs. We appreciate your patience in this transition. This is a big priority for us. Our next meeting will include both a continuation of our water management presentations and an EIS presentation. We'll also have a climate change subcommittee meeting to discuss the pending Clean Air Act Section 111D rule scheduled for release by the EPA that will regulate carbon emissions from existing power plants. I also want to take a quick minute to introduce our new environmental review intern, Amy Wuhuli. She will be helping revise our citizens documents this summer. She attends the University of Minnesota Twin Cities and plans to graduate in December with a degree in environmental science, policy, and management. And since it's a prerequisite for our board chair, she is a graduate of Chaska High School.
Chaska High School. Can you sing the school song?
Mr. Chair, I graduated from Chaska, so it's
I've heard you sing before, often. I think you should keep your day job.
Chaska High School, hats off to thee.
Going downhill.
It is going downhill. Oh, it's the Minnesota Rouser, right?
Same, very similar.
Yeah, you guys weren't creative enough to come up with something different.
It was before my time.
Right. All right. Well, welcome. We look forward to having you on board. So, welcome. At this point, Will, more?
That concludes my report, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
I think I'd like to dive directly into the Minnesota Sands multi-site EIS. And the question before this board will be whether the Erickson site or the Michelle and Tracy Erickson 19.11-acre mine is a phased action to the Minnesota Sands multi-site EIS project, and I want to ask Kate France to come up and please background this whole issue for the board. Welcome, Kate.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, my name is Kate France, and I am the Environmental Review Lead for the EQB staff. I've been asked to cover some of basic concepts about environmental review that are applicable in this case. So if you have any questions moving forward, I can answer those for you. So these are the concepts that we'll be talking briefly about. We'll start with the basics about mandatory categories, what phased and connected actions are, as well as how they are the same or different from cumulative potential effects. But I'll also cover a couple of our little bit more obscure inclusions from the rule, including the related actions EIS process, as well as the variance process. But first, a little history of the project. On March 20th, 2013, the EQB found that pursuant to the requests made by Fillmore and Houston County and input received from Winona County, the sites named in the findings were phased actions proposed by Minnesota Sands, Minnesota Proppant, LLC, that exceeded the mandatory category for an EIS. Specifically, the order reads, the EQB hereby reassigns the status and responsibilities of responsible government unit for silica sand mines proposed by Minnesota Sands, LLC in Fillmore, Houston, and Winona counties from Fillmore, Houston, or Winona County to the Environmental Quality Board. The findings, conclusions, and order named the 19.11-acre Erickson mine site, among others, as phases of this Minnesota Sands multi-site project to be studied in total. Since that finding, we have received the dissolution of contract that is included in your packets, along with a number of additional communications from other parties, all included in your packets for your reference. The question that has been brought forward today by the county on behalf of Mr. Erickson and the project proposer, Minnesota Sands, and is now before the board, is whether or not you can ascertain if a change has been made to, quote, the person or governmental unit that proposes to undertake or to direct others to undertake the project, which, of course, is the definition of proposer from the Minnesota rules. Regarding, specifically, the 19.11-acre Erickson mine site since March of 2013, and thereby determine if the 19.11 acre Erickson mine site is still a phased action of the Minnesota Sands multi-site project. Specifically, pursuant to the definition in Minnesota Rules 4410.0200 subpart 60, phased actions must be proposed by the same entity in the same area and be undertaken over a limited period of time. We'll cover this in just a minute as well. In March of 2013, you found that this was the case. In light of the evidence submitted to date and any comments to be made today, at this time, the question before you is the Erickson site a phased action of the Minnesota Sands multi-site EIS? Approving this resolution would affirm that the Erickson 19.11 acre site is not a phased action and would effectively release them from the multi-site EIS that would be completed by the EQB for the Minnesota Sands project. To reiterate the point made earlier, your decision on this matter does not relieve this project from other environmental review requirements it may be required to complete, nor other potential permitting requirements. Those decisions are not the jurisdiction of this board at this time. To clarify today, sorry, I should have done that forward a little bit. To clarify today, your options are to either adopt the resolution before you, amend and adopt the resolution before you, reject the resolution before you, or not take any action at this time. Okay? So with that, I'd like to cover some of these concepts from environmental review, and if you have any questions, please feel free to stop me at any time. So let's talk first about the mandatory categories. Mandatory categories are defined in Minnesota administrative rules, and they include certain categories for certain types of projects. Of course, the mandatory categories, there are thresholds for EAW categories and for EIS size categories. For a category, this category establishes the threshold for a given for projects, and when a specific project, exceeds that threshold, that EAW or EIS becomes mandatory. The Minnesota Administrative Rules also establish the RGUs for the project types. When comparing projects to the thresholds, an RGU must include phased actions and connected actions, and for EAWs, construction that's begun in the past 3 years. This is commonly referred to as the three-year look-back rule. For non-metallic mineral mining facilities, there are a number of thresholds that may apply. The ones that are currently on the books are the 40 or more acre mining to a mean depth of 10 or more feet during the mine's existence. But there's also currently a rule on the books that for sensitive shoreland areas as well as non-sensitive shoreland areas. And there are similar EIS thresholds for those types of situations as well. There's the 160 acres to a mean depth of 10 feet or more during the existence of the mine. But there are also thresholds for sensitive shoreland areas and non-sensitive shoreland areas. As we'll recall, in 2013, the legislature did make some changes to this category, including one, excavating for a new threshold that for excavating 20 or more acres of land to a mean depth of 10 feet or more during a mine's existence, or B, for projects that are designed to store or are capable of storing more than 7,500 tons of silica sand or have an annual throughput of more than 200,000 tons of silica sand and is not required to get a permit from the Pollution Control Agency. So these are the thresholds that currently stand for non-metallic mineral mine facilities. So let's talk a little bit about phased actions. If you're reading along, this is included in Minnesota Rules 4410.0200 subpart 60, and it identifies that phased actions are projects that meet all of the following criteria. In order for projects to be phased, they must include all these three things. They must be the same proposer, environmental effects occur in the same geographic area, and they are substantially certain to be undertaken sequentially over a limited period of time. So let's take an example. Here we have Mining Company X. And we have Processing Company X. They are the same project proposer, the same company. They occur in the same geographic area. They're going to happen over the same period of time. That means together they need to be reviewed for against the mandatory category threshold, and indeed they need environments review as one environments review for both projects. Conversely, a connected action, which, again, if you're looking, it's in subpart 9C of the definitions in 0200, these connected actions can be connected if they have any of the following relationships. As compared to the project's phased actions, of course, which needed all three conditions, these can be in any of these three conditions. And these three conditions are: one directly induces the other, one is a prerequisite for the other, and the prerequisite is not justified by itself, or neither is justified by itself. In this time, we'll take that same example, except this time we'll call them different companies. But let's just say, and this is hypothetical, this is just an example, that that this mine has a contract with this processing facility, and they will only work together. And so without this mine, that processing facility will not have any sand to process. In this case, one induces is a prerequisite, and neither one is justified on its own. These are connected actions. But it's important to note, connected actions are uncommon. Just because these two might have a relationship does not mean that mine W has a relationship and is connected, or that processing facility Z is a connected action. So we really need that clear identification that one is inducing the other, or that neither are justified by themselves. And that's connected actions. So how does this compare to cumulative potential effects? Well, they're related, but they really are separate concepts. Of course, as we talked about, phased actions, including the three-year look-back rule, and connected actions are determined based on how a project is defined. This happens before the environmental review is initiated, and it's compared altogether. All of your phased actions and connected actions are compared against those mandatory category thresholds to see if an environmental review is required. Conversely, cumulative potential effects, those analyses are handled within the environmental assessment itself. Cumulative potential effects analyses occur as part of EAWs and EISs and should be done regardless of how big or small that project is. So this is the actual definition of cumulative potential effects. As you can see, it's way too small to read. It's a very complex definition. So let's just break it down and talk about the main ideas here. So first is that it's the combined effects of the project being proposed as well as the context of the other projects it's being proposed within. And what does that mean? That involves an environmentally relevant area. We'll get to that in just a minute. But the other thing that you need to take in mind is not just the backdrop of what's already there, but also future projects if they are planned or if there is a basis for expectation that has been laid. So the situation that might be here, and we can certainly go much deeper into this if you'd like, but in general, if there are permits that are in place and impending decisions about other projects, those are projects that may be future projects. They're not already built, but they are planned, or that basis for expectation has been laid. So they would need to be considered as well. So let's talk just a little bit more about the environmentally relevant area. This refers to overlapping environmental footprints, and it is the opinion of EQB staff that this needs to be done on a case-by-case, impact-by-impact analysis. In fact, this is why our EAW form allows for cumulative potential effects to be handled within each natural resource category or as a separate analysis done at the end of the review, because cumulative potential effects on downstream waters could look different than air quality impacts. So, again, same little example. Let's talk about how this happens for cumulative potential effects. So we've got our two little facilities. Remember, we decided they were phased. They're big enough that they need an EIS. But this RGU also has a ballpark that's been proposed. Well, this ballpark is big enough that it needs an EIS. They're not owned by the same proposer. They may or may not be in the same exact geographic area, but they've got some, together, they have some cumulative potential effects. One example, this may not be the only one, but one example might be increased traffic. The mine, the processing facility might have increased traffic due to trucks or other types of things, and that ballpark is going to have people that want to visit the ballpark. So the increased traffic is the cumulative potential effect that needs to be considered within each of those EISs. In the mining and processing facilities EIS, they need to consider the ballpark. In the ballpark, they need to consider the background of the mine and the processing facility. Again, the cumulative potential effects, just underscoring that, occurs within that EIS process. It's not compared to a threshold. The analysis occurs during the environmental review. Okay, so those are sort of those basic concepts. Now I'd like to talk about two things that are a little bit more, we don't encounter them quite as often. And the first being the related actions EIS. Now, this is, again, straight out of the rule. For those of you who are reading along, it's 4410 part 2000 subpart 5. And it specifically, and this is in the part of the rule that is titled for projects requiring an EIS. But it can be a little bit confusing because we start with an RGU may prepare a single EIS for independent projects with potential cumulative environmental impacts. It goes on, and at the bottom it says if this is more efficient than doing a separate EIS, as you can do one. So there's a question here: does this apply to how does this apply with considering the backdrop of phased actions and connected actions that we have? So in some of these cases where it's not exactly explicit, we look to the SONAR for clarification. And here, I wanted to extract this out. This is right from the 1988 form, so I apologize for it being a little bit difficult to read. But really, the key piece is in that second sentence. In this case, the projects dealt with would be projects in geographic proximity, each which requires an EIS, but which are independent projects, i.e. not either connected or phased actions. In some cases, it may be preferable, from an efficiency standpoint, to cover all of the projects in one EIS. Okay, so again, we'll get back to our silly example. We've got our phased action EIS for them, and we've got all our ballpark. Well, for this RGU, they might decide that since they wisely or unwisely decided to put the mining facility and the processing facility right next to that ballpark, we've got some potential cumulative environmental effects, we're going to do one related actions EIS because the EIS was necessary for both sets of actions. We have separate EISs. They are independent. They're not phased or connected, but they're separate EISs that the RGU, for efficiency's sake, can do as one process. Okay. And the final thing I wanted to talk about today was the environmental review variance process. This can also be a little bit confusing because as many of us who deal with regulations, we think of a variance as a variance from the authority that we have. But in this case, the variance, again, if you're reading along, is included in the prohibitions on governmental actions section. So that gives us a starting place. So let's determine what exactly is the variance from? What are we getting a variance from? In fact, the rule contains two different avenues, the first being certain governmental approvals. And what that says is that construction may begin on a project if the proposer applies for and is granted a variance, and we'll get into this a little bit later. That's in subpart 4. And that's for certain governmental approvals, not for environmental review, but for certain governmental approvals, such as permits, CUPs, IUPs, maybe air water permits, those types of things. And then just to note, there is in subpart 9 of our rule a variance process for the for moving around environmental review itself. But as you can see, this is written with extremely strong language. It talks about the rare situation when immediate action by a governmental unit or person is essential to avoid or eliminate an imminent threat to the public health or safety. So this is a pretty high bar. And just for reference, I'm not sure I've only had a few years, but in my tenure and in my understanding from those coming before me, this has not been applied in our EQB history. So could be a little bit wrong, but at least in our memorable history, it's not been applied. So I'm going to walk through this a little bit slowly just to make sure that we are all on the same page about what the variance actually does.
It's a little bit wrong, the same as wrong.
Might be. I could be speaking out of turn that beyond a certain scope of time, I don't have the data to tell you certainly. Thank you for the clarification, Mr. Chair. So for the variance requirements, I think an important piece to look at here is in that second sentence, a variance may be requested at any time after the commencement of the 30-day review period following the filing of an EAW. So this would infer that the 30-day review period is that period when an EAW is on notice in the public, in the EQB monitor, has been noticed for public notice. So the variance can only be applied for after that EAW has been completed, approved by the RGU, and put on public notice. At that point, a variance for certain governmental approvals, like I said, some of those permits could be applied for. That's how this process would work. And as you can see, this has a number of requirements to go along with the variance. Again, this happens after the EAW has already been put on public notice. And that would further go through what happens to the variance application. It gets published as well in the EQB monitor. There's opportunity for public comment. And a decision should be made by the board on the variance itself, not on the environmental review process, but on the variance itself. How is the variance granted? Again, we're looking at this rule. It's all spelled out. First of all, it's really important that the RGU be consenting to the variance. So if the RGU is not the EQB, we need to know that it's not just the project proposer seeking the variance, but that the RGU is in favor of this variance as well. And again, this is assuming that this is occurring after the EAW has already been put on notice. Again, similarly, there are a number of other requirements there. I don't know if we need to get into there, but if you have more questions, we can certainly talk more about that. And then finally, the EQB needs to put forth in writing as part of the record how the written notice or how the variance is determined, whether it's approved or not. And similarly, it's important to note this final piece that, of course, it's only those approvals that have been requested for the variance that are being given for. It's not a carte blanche approval. It's not something that that somehow negates any future decisions or environments review in the future. It is specifically for those approvals that have been sought the variance for. And then here again, we'll just give a little bit more discussion to that emergency action. Again, this is a very high bar. Very, very rarely applied, if ever, and it talks about a extremely rare situation where we have a public health or safety concern. So with that, I'll remind you once again, the question that we have today that's been brought to us is the Erickson mine, 19.11 acre mine in Houston County, a phased action of the Minnesota Sands LLC multi-site project? Now, with that, I'm happy to take any questions on the actual environmental review requirements.
Questions? Thank you, Kate. Mm-hmm. You should consider being a teacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Stein.
Thank you. Kate, when the original letter was sent to Minnesota Sands and the board's decision was carried out. How was it concluded by the board and the staff at that time that the number of sites listed in the letter was the total sum of the sites that might be the subject of the EIS for Minnesota Sands? In other words, could it have been at the time that the submittal was made by the counties asking for a redesignation of the RGU, was everything the 9 or 11 or 10 sites or what was the how and when do we know that we know what the environmental review process is going to look at?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Commissioner, and members of the board. I want to be careful with how I talk about our history because I wouldn't want to be in the case of doing revisionist history. I have a very good friend who's a PhD in history, and she would blanch if I were to do that. So so I'll be careful here. And of course, we can look back into the record to get a clear understanding of what was discussed at that March 2013 meeting. That said, to give you an understanding of how the environmental review process moves forward is for an RGU to determine that a project exists. And so in this case, the project became, we became aware of a project, which was Minnesota Sands, and that project we knew was at least composed of the sites that were identified by these three counties. Of course, a full project description and the environmental review process had not moved forward yet because that would require a scoping agreement that would be signed, and that would include a project description, and that would define the complete project at that point. So in March, it was this awareness of the project, determination of the RGU for that Minnesota Sands project, but a complete project description had not yet been defined.
So, Ms. Chair, thank you, Kate. The finding we made in our findings of fact, number 27, at that March meeting says, the EQB finds that in the instances of Boyum, Dobbelstein, Kessler, Wadowitz sites in Fillmore County, and the Erickson, Tostenson, Olson, Chapel, and Johnson sites in Houston County, no EAW has been started. Therefore, no completed data portion of the new EAW has yet been received by an RGU, or EQB. So I, too, want to be cautious about revisionist history. What that statement can say or can be read to say is that here's a list, and in these instances, there's no data provided yet. So we're not done scoping, is part of the message I would take from that, because there hasn't been a full description of the sites, the characteristics of the projects on those sites, and we don't have that data to rely upon. And I just wanted to point that out for board members, because what I want to be mindful of as we're thinking through this today is what is the means by which we scope a phased action EIS, because we're being asked to make a scoping determination in part today is what I feel. So I just want to set that on the table and hear more presentation before we move forward.
Okay, thanks, John. Help me understand this a little bit better. In common farmer talk.
Do my best, sir.
So here you have this company called Minnesota Sands, right? It's an LLC. But you have, and they have several mines that are part of the LLC. And at some point, the owners of the Erickson property said, yeah, this is a great idea. We want to be part of this consortium or LLC. And then they changed their mind prior to any scoping document being completed, prior to any EAW being completed. What is our responsibility then from an EQB board perspective? Is it to just make the determination as to whether they should be included or not included? Isn't that what we're here to make a decision on today? And what more information does one need, given the fact that we have no scoping document, we have no information? Basically, we're here to answer the question, shall they be released from their commitment to be part of Minnesota Sands, or shall they not be released? And my sense is that we need to sort of narrow our focus, narrow the discussion on that question. What am I missing?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, First of all, I can't presume what the relationship was or was not between any of the landowners and Minnesota Sands. That ultimately is a good question for any of those parties. I can certainly provide any answers on the rule specifically. But in terms of what our responsibility as the RGU, as I said, is to determine what the project is and determine what the complete project is and compare that against the mandatory category thresholds that we have in rule, basically to uphold the environmental review program. So if we understand that the project includes a large number of sites, then it is our responsibility to do an adequate review for that project so that better decision making can be made. Again, remember that an environmental review is an information gathering process that should be supportive of governmental decisions. It's not indeed it's not another type of tool. It's not an enforcement tool. It's an information gathering process. So the point is to gather information on the complete project.
So what more then would the board need to make a determination as to whether they're in or out, given the fact that they said they're out? Do we need to have them say, and we really mean it?
Mr. Chair.
Or where do we go from here? Commissioner.
Thank you. So not wanting to shortcut this conversation, but I noticed that you had a few purple slips in front of you. And I wondered if anyone is here from Minnesota Sands that's willing to answer some questions before the board today on so that we could open the dialogue maybe at that point on to your question, which is how satisfied is the board with the response?
I have no one from Minnesota Sands that's requested to testify, Commissioner.
Thank you.
And have three, four that have, but not none from the company.
Thank
Commissioner
you.
Landwehr?
Mr. Chairman, maybe this is getting to the same question, and it may be something that we would have some information on. Do we know what the mechanism was for Erickson Mine to become part of the Minnesota Sands project, and if we do, is there an equivalent document that shows the dissolution of that?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, Mr. Chair, members of the board, you've received the full amount of information that the EQB staff have received. I would encourage you to speak to those parties that are here today to answer those types of questions.
So, Mr. Chair, I read the packet rather thoroughly. I saw the copy of the dissolution agreement that was signed between the Ericksons and Minnesota Sands. There was no original lease or agreement copy in those materials. So we don't know what they originally signed to enter the agreement, but we do see what they signed to exit the agreement.
Well, would anyone from Minnesota Sands care to go on the record and come up and speak to those questions? Or the Erickson or their representative would be pleased to have you come up and address these. Thank you. Kate, maybe you just want to slide over for a second and allow our testifier. Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Tracy Erickson, the owner of the mine.
Thanks for being here, Tracy.
Hello, I'm Richard Frick.
Minnesota Thank you, Sands. Richard, for being here.
I can start out. Myself and my wife own the mine together. We bought the property several years ago, and we were in agreement with Minnesota Sands for a short time. And in the packet, you'll see a dissolution of contract dated in September of 2013. It's real clear we're not in business together and won't be in the future. Also, there's in the packet a letter written by Mr. Frick addressing Jeff Smizer from the EQB board, very clearly stating that we are not in business together and won't be in the future. Thank you for your time.
Questions?
Thank you.
For Mr. Erickson?
Mr. Chair.
If you're willing.
Just a quick question. Thank you for being here, Mr. Erickson. The I noticed in the dissolution agreement there was a statement under number four that says that there was payment made for the between the parties regarding a security agreement into any and all assets that all parties may own. I was confused by what assets all parties may own meant. Can you clarify that for me?
Mr. Erickson?
Yes. The $25,000 was the amount of money in which my wife and I would receive to separate in this contract. And the security would be for Mr. Frick to provide that in cash or securities. I would go against them to retain my money.
I see. A second, Mr. Chair, if I could continue.
Mr. Stein.
Thank you. There, under number eight, was a statement that you and your wife would transfer to Mr. Frick two shares that Mr. Frick transferred to you. Wasn't clear what the shares referred to.
When I originally went with Minnesota Sands, there was a verbal agreement that I would obtain two shares in the company. There was never a written documentation of those shares. It was a verbal agreement, and this would clarify and spell out that I have no ties to Minnesota Sands whatsoever.
So your verbal understanding with Mr. Frick was that in the course of time you would get two shares of the company, and now this just if I understood you correctly, this is just saying you no longer have that agreement.
That is true. It was okay. A verbal agreement, and we have no ties whatsoever with
thank you
Sands.
I don't have any other questions for Mr. Erickson. I have questions for Mr. Frick.
Any Commissioner Rothman?
Sure. Just to follow up on some of these legal questions, and I had some of the same. This, first of all, was there anything more than an oral agreement or a lease that you had a written document of some sort of the business relationship between the parties?
There was a written lease, sir, but it was an oral agreement on the shares.
So other than the written lease and the oral agreement on the two shares, was there any other agreements in writing that the parties entered into?
There's no agreements in writing and no other oral agreements, sir. It okay. is what it is.
And then, because you had indicated when you testified, but not in the document, that you had referenced this contract. So was there any other oral agreements between the parties other than the transfer of the lease that you had entered into?
No, sir.
Okay, so then This document contemplates that some steps had to be made to complete it, right? So this payment had to be made, and did you have the two shares already? Were they transferred back, or you never received them in the first place?
Again, I reiterate the fact that they were oral, and it was an oral agreement, and by signing this, that would terminate that oral agreement.
And so did you get that $25,000 payment?
I did.
Okay. So then as far as you're concerned, you've received everything you were all the steps have been completed to execute and complete this dissolution.
That is correct. I'm 100% divorced from Minnesota Sands. Okay.
In the future, do you expect to do any business with between the companies?
I will never mine frac sand in the United States. I want nothing to do with it.
Okay.
Well, just Commissioner Landwehr.
Quick additional question: was the oral agreement that got you into the agreement with Minnesota Sands? Is there a date by which that was considered official?
You're being a little confusing, sir. And I'm not. The oral agreement was only on the two shares.
Okay.
Be very specific in that. There was a written lease. I'm not trying to hide anything. There was a written lease agreement between Minnesota Sands and my wife. And that's what this dissolution is describing, the termination of the written lease agreement. And the oral part was strictly the fact of the two shares, sir.
Okay. And so when was the written agreement? We don't have the original written agreement. Do you know the date that was signed?
That was signed over 2 years ago, and that's expired too now.
Mm-hmm. May of 2014.
I apologize. Excuse me?
I think it was in the summer of
12
when we first signed. It had to be in May, and then we drilled there and stuff, and then we got shut down. And then after that, it was just a long story, but after that I had three other sites, sorry about that, and they're all expired. Two will be expired in the next month. So that's why I probably will never do nothing in Houston.
Mr. Frick, for the record, you might want to identify yourself.
All right, I'm Richard Frick. I'm from Houston, Minnesota. And if any other questions I can help you with, I will.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
Thank you. Thanks for being here, Mr. Frick. The question I had was similar to Commissioner Landwehr's, the date that you entered into those written agreements for leases. You said it was more than 2 years ago, and those leases contained, you said, an expiration clause that expired 2 years from the date of signing. Would that be correct?
All four of them had an expiration date. Two are already expired, and the other two will expire very shortly, and I'm not going to re-sign them. Houston County has moratoriums. I'm going to go to Winona and Fillmore, where there is no moratoriums, do the EIS on 9 or 10 sites, and that's where I'm going to do business. I will not do nothing in Houston County, and I'm not doing an EIS on Houston County. It's only going to be on Winona and Fillmore.
Thank you.
So you have other project sites, though, that are in Houston County. Is that correct?
There's not really, not anymore, because they're expiring. And I'm not going to pay $50,000 a contract when there's another moratorium in effect for another year. When they expire in 30 days, why should I pay that? I'm not going to do that. I'm not fighting the moratoriums. I'm not fighting Houston County. I'm moving on and doing the sites that I have in Winona and Fillmore. And that means doing EIS. There's 9 to 10 sites, and they're all in Winona and Fillmore. Them are the only two counties I'm doing the EIS on.
Okay, and then back to the two shares. You no longer have two shares in Minnesota Sands. Is that correct? Mr. Erickson, please.
Yes, that is 100% correct, sir.
Other questions? Commissioner Rothman?
This is to Mr. Erickson. Can you describe your plans for your site then, and the current status of the permitting, and what your expectation is with respect to potential or future environmental review that you may have to do for your plans?
Mr. Erickson?
My plan is to continue my permit that's been in place for 22 years that's deeded and included onto my deed of my property to haul construction sand that is permitted in Houston County. Throughout Houston County, it does not fall underneath the moratorium for construction sand. My permit is at this point going to be reviewed tomorrow night by the planning board for an extension. It's limited to 10,000 yards under that, and at that point, my mine at 10,000 yards will be the smallest mine permitted in Houston County.
Mr. Chair, just following up, what is your expectation with respect to the environmental review or not, depending upon what the decisions are made?
I 100% believe that I should not be included in the environmental review as it's construction sand. I'm 19 acres, and I'm underneath any kind of threshold like that, sir.
Commissioner Landwehr?
Just to follow up on some of that, Mr. Erickson, if I could. It's my understanding that the conditional use permit actually expired.
It's not true, sir.
It has not been reauthorized.
If I can explain that to you.
Mr. Erickson.
The expiration was January 8th, 2013. Mm-hmm. I put in November 1st to have my permit renewed. The county zoning administrator and their office, along with the county, mm-hmm. all agreed that I put my renewal in time, and they put it in suspension. Mm-hmm. It hasn't expired. My renewal request was put in time. So that is a false statement that it's expired.
So there's a documented action somewhere by the county to essentially extend the permit?
There's a documented that I put in for my renewal in November of 2012 for the expiration of 2013, and that I met the deadline so that the permit would not expire.
But,
Mr. Lander,
if the board doesn't take specific action on an application, it doesn't extend by itself automatically by lack of action. It's sort of like a tabled.
The zoning administrator is here today, sir, and he'd be able to explain that to you, as I'm trying to do.
Okay, we might want to call him up. The other thing with respect to Commissioner Rothman's question on EAW or EIS is my understanding that the board also required you to do an EAW, or they put forward notice that an EAW would be required.
If I could read you a form. A statement from the entire Houston County Commissioners dated April 8th of 2014. Motion was made by Commissioner Schultz, seconded by Commissioner Storley, and unanimously carried to direct the staff to work with Mr. Erickson in processing his renewal request and extend any applicable 60-day period an additional 60 days. In addition, the board concludes the processing of the renewal request is not prohibited by the express language of the moratorium. Thereby, any pending EAW or EIS process, the board further directs the staff to provide notice of the board determination to the affected property owners. That being said, I think it clarifies to you that the board knows that my permit has not expired. I think it also clarifies the fact that they are not requesting the EAW or an EIS to be done on my property. This is also included in, I believe, in your packet. Thank you.
Take a look for that. Thank you.
I assume you're talking about Mr. Scanlon. Is he present?
Yes, sir.
And would you care to, since your name has been raised by title, you might want to just slide over a little bit, Mr. Frick, and allow Mr. Scanlon to welcome to the committee, Mr. Scanlon.
Thank you.
Can you please identify yourself for the record?
Bob Scanlon, Planning and Zoning Administrator, Houston County.
Your question initially.
Mr. Chair.
Was directed toward Mr.
Scanlon. Right. I think the conversation we just concluded was that Mr. Erickson said that he had a conditional use permit that was attached to that expired in. The date on the permit expired January 8, 2013, that he applied in November 2012 to extend or renew the conditional use permit. And then he just read us some language from an April 8, 2014 Houston County Board meeting. My question, I think the question was, has the Mr. Erickson said that your statement was that the county would consider his extension request valid and allow him to proceed with the renewal request for the conditional use permit past the extension or past the expiration date in January. I think what we're looking for from you, Mr. Scanlon, is just exactly what, if everything transpired exactly that way and if that's documented in any other way other than the county board's minutes.
Yeah, what he explained is correct. He had a November 1st, 2012 renewal submission to the Houston County Zoning Office. So he did meet his deadline to apply to renew the five-year permit on time. The reason it was not renewed in January 2013 is because of an impending EAW process because he was tied with Minnesota Sand at the time. that circumstance has since changed, and that is the reason for the board directive that he just read to you in April.
So, Mr. Chair, there isn't like any correspondence that you sent to Mr. Erickson that summarizes any of this. It just pretty much happened in your office and with the county board at their meeting. Would that be accurate?
I'm sure I've sent letters and talked to him numerous times in the last year to discuss.
Maybe a question is if It would be very helpful to see any written documentation of your interactions about the renewal request.
Mr. Erickson.
I filled out the form on November 12th, and it was a written form signed by myself prior to the expiration, and I believe that would be on file in the zoning if that's what you're requesting.
Yeah, if that's what you mean, yes, there's a copy of that.
Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Commissioner
That's would be helpful, but I also think if there was any exchange of correspondence, email or otherwise, between the zoning office and Mr. Erickson in the intervening time, like we've got 60 days. I know that you're under 60-day rule and you had, you know, some decisions to make in that process, and maybe there are things you communicated less formally, but anything that was formally communicated would be good to see.
There is a letter,
Mr. Scanlon,
that we had, and I forget the date of it, but this spring we had determined, and our land use attorney had determined, that the 60-day clock started at the time that he submitted his dissolution agreement with Minnesota Sand. I believe that day was February 27th of this year. Our determination that 60-day clock started that day. And we submitted a letter to Mr. Erickson at that time stating as such. We also submitted in that same letter that we'd like to extend that 60-day deadline an additional 60 days to work with EQB on questions that have arisen during this process. So there is a letter to Mr. Erickson regarding that.
Thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Erickson or Mr. Frick or Mr. Scanlon?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Erickson, I'm interested in understanding the difference between the construction sand versus frack sand process.
Mr. Erickson.
It's a volume process. Originally, they were talking a large volume of sand, and as I stated earlier, I'm looking at 10,000 yards. It's also the use of that sand. I'm looking at construction purposes. In southeastern Minnesota, there's a large demand for construction sand, which is commonly used for bedding for animals. And I have a verbal contract that for the 10,000 yards to go for bedding sand. And that's what I'm looking at.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. Thank you. Further questions?
Mr. Chair. Mr. Erickson, is bedding sand, I thought that was a silica sand product. Bedding sand is a silica sand product.
Mr. Erickson.
It's sand. You could use beach sand if you lived on the beach. I'm not trying to be smart mouth, ma'am. Sand is sand. I guess I don't know what the question is. My permit's been in place for 22 years. It's been used to build bridges. It's been used to build grain elevators. And it's been used for construction projects for fill, and that's what I'm looking to do with it.
I was referencing Mr. Squire's letter. Can anyone else tell me more about the distinction between silica sand used for bedding and silica sand? The silica sand used for bedding. Silica sand. This question is in the packet somewhere. I can't quite find it.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Stein.
I believe you're looking. Mr. Squires wrote a letter May 14, 2013 to Mr. Scanlon and got into the question of the ultimate use of the sand isn't as, is, I'm quoting from the second page of his letter, says the end use of the mined material is irrelevant. If you're mining silica sand, you are mining silica sand. So the question that was being addressed was at the time, and he goes on in that same paragraph to talk about 21,000 cubic yards of sand being proposed for mining, but then he states that the 1992 conditional use permit was issued based on representation that 8 to 10,000 cubic yards of sand would be removed per year. And then goes on to more details in what the understanding of the county's conditional use permit was.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In that same letter, Mr. Scanlon or whoever might know, the board It says the board also found that the project should have been treated as a mandatory EAW in 1992. Can somebody tell me? That's in the same letter from Scanlon. Can somebody tell me what the basis for that was on the part of the board, or maybe on the part of the...
Yeah, I can try and answer.
Mr. Scanlon.
The description of the mine when it was approved in 1992 was for an 80-acre parcel, and that was what the permit was granted for. Well, since that time, 41 acres of that 80 has been sold off. But that was the basis for the comment from Mr. Squires that the original permit was about roughly an 80-acre parcel. And if you look, remember the thresholds that were discussed earlier, if it's 40-plus acres with a depth of 10 foot, that's a requirement for an EAW. I'm not sure what the EAW requirements were in 1992, mm-hmm. but that's what it is today.
And Mr. Chair, and other parties, I'm not sure who's going to answer this. That's why I think my question about Mr. Squire's letter stating that he believed that he was interpreting the court to say that silica sand is silica sand, because if, in fact, this property will be being mined for silica sand for bedding, it was Mr. Squire's impression that that would potentially, and this is my question for staff, that would potentially fall under the rule passed, or the temporary threshold passed by the legislature in 2012, that is a 20-acre limit rather than a 40-acre limit. We have, 19.1 mm-hmm. acres?
Mm-hmm. We're under that.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Is Mr. Squires in the audience?
I don't believe so.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, just by way of making note for the board, there is a letter dated April 21, 2014 from Mr. Scanlon to the landowners explaining the 60-day rule determination. It is basically explaining how the April 8th county board meeting, motion was made, et cetera, et cetera. I think it follows the language of Mr. Erickson read, that there'd be any applicable 60-day rule period be extended for an additional 60 days. In addition, board further directs staff to provide notice of the board's determination to affected property owners and EQB. So that letter is in the packet, as Mr. Scanlon said. I just wanted to make it clear that we do have a copy of it.
Okay. Other questions for Kristen?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I do have another question. I've read entirely too much about the siting projects in Wisconsin, and one of the issues that's come up consistently in Wisconsin is the confusion over kind of shifting ownership of companies and operators. And one of my confusions regarding the contract that's been presented is what specifically Mr. Frick's relationship is with each of the entities, Minnesota Sands and Minnesota Proppant, and how is each company bound by his signature? Are you, Mr. Frick, the principal owner of each of those companies? And so there really isn't anybody else to account for that.
Excuse me, for the record, if you could answer audibly into the microphone. All right. It's all being webcast and taped, so it's all important.
Yes, yeah. I am the owner of both of them. I started both of them. And I own them. I'm the, I don't know what you want to
You're
call
it.
It. I'm it.
For the record, that's Mr. Frick answering. Yeah. Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none, I think we're at a point where, I'm sorry.
I did have a couple additional questions that came up with respect to my earlier questions and with the discussion on the letter of May 14th to Mr. Scanlon from Mr. Squires. And a couple of things, and I'm going to tell you candidly, part of my questioning relates to whether or not the project would require a trout stream permit, because if the conditional use permit expired, in my opinion, it's a new project, and then it's subject to the new law and trout stream setbacks, and you're less than 1,500 feet from a trout stream. But here's the things I'm looking at, if I could, Mr. Erickson. The letter from Attorney Squires says that the CUP expired at the beginning of this year. It just flat out says it. It doesn't say it's been extended, but he goes on to say that the pending, in his opinion, the pending EAW is still required. The final action prohibition that's in the rules would apply in this case, and the mine would not be allowed to be operated until the EAW is required. But, and one last thing, if I could, please. I've seen some of the Planning Commission discussion around the original issuance of this permit in 1992, and it talked about the mine being used for 8,000 to 10,000 cubic yards for the completion of a bridge project. And somewhere along the line, this has been transformed into 8,000 to 10,000 yards per year. And I don't know whether or not the bridge project actually that was referenced has been completed, but it seems that the current consideration for conditional use permit is much greater than the original consideration for a permit. So any information on those things?
Mr. Erickson.
I think I can answer that for you, sir. If in your research, I think you failed to see that the original request was a one-year request for 8,000 to 10,000 yards for a bridge project. Mm-hmm. Mr. Thorson then came in the preceding year, the following year, and asked for a conditional use permit, which was granted, and it was good for 5 years. So you are correct in the first one-year bridge project, one-time use. But where you failed to mention is that it was a conditional use permit application the following year, which was granted and has been every 5 years.
So he get a permit, a conditional use permit in 92 and 93?
Bob will be able to answer that, too, to validate this. But it was a one-time use conditional use permit to build a bridge on the south side of Rushford on Highway 43. And then he came back in and said, instead of coming in every year and every time I need one, can I just get a conditional use permit? And they granted that. So those are two separate, complete separate situations. And that's what a lot of people are trying to do, is confuse those two separate situations.
So there are two different permits, is what you're saying, 92 and 93.
And in 1993 is the permit that's been renewed every 5 years as of today.
And I've not seen a copy of that. Is anybody here have a copy of that, 1993? So the other thing is, with respect to the EAW, the attorney advising the county suggests that the EAW is still required.
I don't know if maybe I
Mr.
could help clarify that. At the time, with the circumstances as they were, and that's also stated by Mr. Squires at the bottom of that letter in the last paragraph, that he mentioned those requirements as situations existed at that time, that he was currently under an EAW because of ties with Minnesota Sand, and it was considered silica sand mining at the time. So that was his point in making that statement, was that the circumstances that persisted at that time would call for that.
Thank you for that. I'm not certain that because of the dissolution that this provision has gone away, the rules still require that an EAW petition be dismissed, and the county board has not taken that action to dismiss the EAW. They have to dismiss the petition for an EAW, not just say you don't need an EAW.
Mr. Erickson.
I believe I read that to you, and that clarified that, and it is in your packet, that Mr. Squires advised the county board during closed session, and when they came out, they unanimously stated that that it did not need the EAW or the EIS for construction sand purposes. That's clear.
No, we may disagree on that.
Further questions, Commissioner Rothman?
Mr. Chair, I want to go back to the agreement between the parties so I get a... I had a chance to take a look at some of these. I just want to check the boxes to see if I'm understanding and following along with the agreement that you've entered into in terms of what your expectations are. in particular, I wanted to I don't have a copy of the real estate document, but I assume it is as you described it, and that's going to be terminated based on what you said before. In paragraph 5 and 6, just so I understand this, is it the party's understanding, maybe both of you can answer this.
Can I interrupt you, sir? I don't know where you're at.
Just describe it. Paragraph 5 of the agreement talks about you, Mr. Erickson, completing all the matters necessary to obtain, it says, his existing permit from Houston County. So this paragraph plus the next one, it actually goes on to say that Richard Frick, Minnesota Sands, and Minnesota Propen agree to pay any and all attorney's fees and complete all actions necessary to obtain his prior permit back from Houston County. So is that true that, in essence, the purpose of this is to put you back in the place you would have been in if you hadn't entered into this arrangement to go down the road you had, and what you're trying to do is, between the two of you, put Mr. Erickson back in the place he was before entering into the kind of the deal you guys struck?
Mr. Erickson?
100% trying to obtain what I've had and what my property and my deed has had for going on 22 years, sir. I'm not trying to get anything extra. I'm just trying to stay whole. And I think it's been obvious here that there is a dissolution of contract that's been signed, dated, notarized, and drawn up. I've told you I can't double tell you that I'm not going to be in business with Mr. Frick. It's on the record. And I'm not in business with him.
I understand that. And then in paragraph 6, it talks about the specifics is that you would get your permit back to be consistent with the way it was before, correct? Yeah. So this hasn't happened yet, but it's in the process. You guys are working, you know, you're committed to completing this process, and you're working on your end to try to get this permit, and the county is doing it, but it hasn't been done yet, and it has not been. So in effect, I'm just curious, you've entered into the dissolution contract, but I go back to my question before as I further read it. It hasn't been complete, all of the conditions haven't been completed to totally effectuate the termination, the dissolution. You've separated ways, but these are the conditions of the, so I mean, if something, so for example, if this didn't happen, you'd still have concerns between you. You'd still have these contract terms that wouldn't be completed if you didn't get your permit back the way it was. But that's the expectation of what you're trying to accomplish.
That's why we're here today, sir, is to get to be freed so that I can continue to my process of renewing my permit.
And has the lawsuit been dismissed?
Yes.
Okay.
Other questions?
I'm sorry.
All right.
Chair, Mr. Frick, Jeff Smizer wrote a letter in March 25th to you regarding the kind of detail that he would like to have about any past, current, anticipated future associations between you, not limited to partnership, ownership, shareholder, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't think we've received anything specific to that level, and I don't see anything in your current contract that actually, other than your stating that you will have no future associations, I don't see anything in the contract that that bars that or assures us that there's no future associations. And so I wondered, that's a similar concern that I have with the lack of an EAW. Is the EAW is the only place that it would be necessary to anticipate and reveal what potential expansions or phased actions might be considered by the mine owner as these other mines, you know, come to fruition. There's no way that we would know anything about that, or anybody would know anything about that without an EAW, which requires that kind of information. You know, for instance, is washing and crushing part of the original CUP?
Mr. Scanlon?
Yes, it was. It wasn't limited to anything. The only two conditions on the permit were that you would come in and get it renewed every 5 years, and that he would, the owner of the property would maintain some screening, natural screening, along the road. So to answer your question, yes, mining doesn't, and extraction in Houston County does include screening and stockpiling of material and processing of material on the mine site.
It does it, Mr. Scanlon, include washing? Sorry, Mr. Washing, does it include washing?
Yes. There are several mines in Houston County that are washing material today. So that's part of mining in Houston County. There are currently 140-plus mines registered on the county mining list. All of them have an opportunity to wash, which falls under the lump sum of processing in Houston County. Any type of screening, sorting, stockpiling, extracting, it's all part of mining in Houston County. So,
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I had one question for the staff regarding the EIS, whether or not how this particular project might be looked at in the relationship to the related actions, and whether there's any chance, so Mr. Erickson is aware, and whether there's any chance that this mine might actually be scoped back in to the EIS as the EIS does its due diligence regarding defining the project, which may this is just a, like 12 miles, isn't it? I mean, how big is this area in which the projects are clustered?
I don't know.
Mr. Yeah. Frick?
Mr. Frick, yes, you know.
Yeah, the only ones that are close are up in Fillmore and Winona County. Houston is probably 35 miles away from the biggest majority of my leases.
Okay.
Tracy's is out in the middle of nowhere. It's not even close to, like I said, you're probably 35 miles from Winona and Fillmore's sites.
Okay, well, that was my question as to whether or not, and I guess we don't really know till it's scoped, but whether or not that may end up in a scope
for
related actions.
I volunteered to do the EIS, but I've never put no sites in on this yet. I've never told anybody on what sites I'm going to do the EIS on. Houston County is completely out of it. The only, like I explained before, we're only doing these on Winona and Fillmore. I'm not doing nothing in Houston County. And far as going back with him, that's never going to happen. I'm not going to fight and beat my head against the wall for moratoriums and stuff. I'm going to where I can mine. I've wasted too much time and money already.
So, Tracy, your property is in the middle of nowhere, huh? I thought.
Yeah, actually, it's on the map.
I thought. I guess there are two middle of nowheres then, right? So I thought I lived in the middle of nowhere.
You do live in the middle of nowhere, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Stein.
Thank you. Question for Mr. Frick, just on your statement that you've said that you're gonna submit some documentation for the completion of the EIS scoping. We haven't gotten any of that yet.
Yes, I know. And I haven't told nobody yet. I talked to Denise today, and we will get you a list, and it will be on the two main counties, Fillmore and Winona. You'll get your list, and that's where the EIS will be done.
When might we expect that list?
Within 30 days.
So just by way of helping the discussion along, let me say what I think would be very helpful is we got the list in time for us to notice it prior to our next board meeting, and then we could dispense with this action of releasing Mr. Erickson and his wife from this circle of administrative turmoil that they're in, and try to dispense with the determination of how we're going to scope the actual EIS, because then we would have something on which we could rely. So, not a question to you, Mr. Erickson. I'm just advising the board of what I think would be prudent in this case, which is we have Mr. Frick's statement for the board that he wants to exclude sites in Houston County. It would be useful if we got the cost agreement material back and a statement on which sites are going to be considered active parcels for the completion of the EIS, and then we could notice that prior to our next board meeting, and then we could act on this matter at that meeting. That would be my preference.
Well, my sense, Commissioner Stein, not to be argumentative, but it wouldn't be the first time that these two questions are not, pardon the pun here, necessarily phased and connected. We should be able to deal with this on its face and answer the question, are they or are they not in? The second portion of it, which you would like to tie together, and I get that, I think could be dealt with on its face also. So my preference would be to act on the resolution and then deal with the second part of your point individually.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Not to be argumentative. However, the benefit of my proposal, in my opinion, is that it would accomplish two goals in a reasonably short period of time.
All right. I tell you what, thank you, the three of you, for taking the time to come up. Mr. Frick, find closing comment, and then Mr. Erickson.
Yeah, I just...
And as long as we get the two of you, might as well have Mr. Scanlon close, too. So
I just want to make clear that I'm not doing an EIS on Houston County. My opinion is, and just my opinion, he should be released. He's not going to – I'm never going to mine there. If I have to sign something that says I'm never going to mine there, I'm not going to mine there. I'm not going to mine in Houston County, period. I don't think you should hold him captive on something that we signed and it's all dissolved. We're no longer together. And as far as Houston County, the same thing. I want to see him get on with his life and use – I mean, when he bought this site, this is part of his income. I mean, you shouldn't take that away from him. He's already suffered 2 years on something that we can't do. So I think in his defense, he should be released today. And I don't know what else to tell you, but I haven't started. I haven't paid nobody any money for the EIS or nothing yet. So realistically, nothing has started.
We're aware of that, by the way.
Exactly. Thank you.
Mr. Erickson.
I would just like to close and just make the statement that, again, reiterating what Rick said, this is on public record. And I'm not mining with Minnesota Sands. We've made that evidently clear. So the fact of tabling this situation for another 30 days is just, in my humble opinion, is just another stalling of me getting on with going forward and, you know, mining as I did prior to. And I guess that's what I'd like to close with. And thank you for your time. I know this is a busy time.
Thank you. Mr. Scanlon, any closing comments?
Mr. Erickson's renewal request comes up to the Planning Commission tomorrow night. It was tabled a month ago because we wanted to speak with you folks about this. And so I guess determination today would be greatly appreciated back in Houston County for the Planning Commission tomorrow night.
Thank you. I'd like to ask David Williams. David wanted to go first because of your schedule, and so welcome, Mr. Williams. Please identify yourself for the... Kate, come on up if you'd like, please.
Commissioner Fredrickson, members of the board, I'm David Williams of Williams Consultancy in Fillmore County. I am speaking in opposition to the proposal to release the Erickson property from the Minnesota Sands EIS at this time. I'm here to talk about process. There are essentially two processes for releasing the Erickson property: scoping and the variance. Scoping has not yet occurred and is about to begin. Mr. Frick has informed the EQB, he informed you today, that he is ready to begin the scoping process. The scoping process is important because it identifies, one, the mine sites that you put in your order a year ago, and it also describes some of the environmental impacts or potential environmental impacts of those mining sites. And that's a part of the scoping process and a part of the process of moving along. The variance process. Erickson has not applied to the EQB for a variance. Executive Director Soifert stated that in his letter to Houston County Commissioner Dana Chomey dated April 29, 2014, a copy of which is in your board packet. In his explanation of environmental review, Seifert cites the prohibitions on county government permitting decisions and on beginning construction and mining under Rule 4410-3100. The variance process contained within that rule. Seifert further says, quote, the EQB has not received a variance application regarding the Erickson mine. And then he cites Rule 3100. The purpose of that rule is not just to make a proposer jump through some process hoops. It's to try to get Erickson to complete an application that shows the anticipated environmental impacts of what he is doing and what he's trying to get released from doing. Erickson is not just a guy saying, I'm not going to mine anymore, I'm going home and not doing anything. He's going to mine. He's going to mine the very same silica sand that he was going to mine a year ago with Minnesota Sands. It's interesting that there is no recommendation from the staff to let Erickson out. You know, the staff did not take a position on this. So is it contemplated to let Erickson out of this today just on the scant information that you have gotten from Erickson, Scanlon, and Frick today? Is that it? For you to make your decision on whether it is appropriate to let him out of that EIS that you had ordered a year ago? I don't think so. Even if you are inclined to release the Erickson property from the EIS, you should at least require them to complete the EAW process that was well underway in 2012 and early 2013. And remember, that was a petition process that was initiated by neighbors and residents and people in the community that was published in the Monitor, accepted by Houston County, and began. It has engineered documents. It has a draft of an EAW. The only thing that pretty much stopped that EAW was you guys taking it over as the redesignated RGU. That environmental review needs to be completed. If this proposed site were to be located in an industrialized area of Houston County, one might be tempted to say, no harm, no foul. Let the guy go and let him mine whatever he wants to mine. But it isn't. This proposed location is in one of the most environmentally sensitive areas of Houston County. Two designated trout streams, the Root River and Ferndale Creek, the major bike trail in the region, along the historic Bluff County Scenic Byway, a golf course right across the road, a fish hatchery, sensitive bluffs, and quiet rural residences and farms. There's nothing else. There's no commerce. There's no industry in that area. Please do this thing right. Make Erickson go through environmental review for once, or at least explain why he should not be required to go through environmental review. Take adequate time to confirm the facts that have been presented to you today with all of the questions that you have had before you make a decision. Please don't try to make a decision just based upon this scant testimony that you've gotten today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Questions for Mr. Williams? Seeing none, thank you very much. I'd like to ask...
It's a clarification.
Pardon me?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I heard two questions from the board that I felt the staff could help with.
Please.
First of all, the first question was as to what in 1992 the threshold was. And in fact, I can tell you that due to our sonars, the non-metallic mineral mining of 40 acres was in place since 1992. The shoreland categories, those thresholds, were put into place in 2007. So just a clarification, 1982 was when those were instituted. And similarly, the related actions EIS, I heard that there was a question about that, and I just wanted to clarify that that is for multiple EIS-level projects, just to re-go over that, that that's multiple projects that each by themselves are at an EIS requirement. So unless there are any follow-up questions, I just wanted to provide that response.
Questions for Kate? Seeing none.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chairperson Walter.
Thank
welcome to the board.
Teresa Walker, commissioner in Houston County. And actually, I think everything's been covered by Katie very well, what I was going to say.
Well, given the fact that Houston County is referenced at least in every breath here, it might
exactly.
be good
We're
to,
here.
To hear a little bit
from
your perspective. So thanks for being here, Teresa.
And we have been dealing with this, and we're actually just here to clarify whether the EQB is the RGU for this project. Because from our understanding at this point, the Erickson mine is not part of Minnesota Sands at this time from the papers that we have seen. And they're seeking a renewal of that conditional use permit, you know, for construction sand only. And you do have all your information in your packets that we have also.
Okay. Commissioner Stein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here today. A question, were the EQB to determine that the Erickson's property was not subject to the EIS and would be, therefore, not the EQB would not be the RGU for the project, would Houston County intend to take up the question of environmental review on its own?
It would go back to the Planning Commission. They have to, even for all conditional use permits, they have to meet all state standards through the MPCA and all the state governing bodies. And also they can add more conditions as needed for the up-to-date situation.
So in other words, it wouldn't necessarily roll back to the way it used to be?
It doesn't automatically. It would go back, but the Houston County would make the decision. As a new governing unit.
RGU. And we would be.
RGU.
You asked the question, and I asked legal counsel, and we are the RGU until we act.
And that's really what we're here for, is to get a clarification, whether you're not going to be the RGU anymore, and it would go back to us.
Commissioner Zelli.
So this 60-day period, what day do you view that starting?
We had a 60-day starting February 27th, but we extended it another 60 days with notification. So we actually have 120 days.
So you have not.
And that is due, I believe, June 27th, if I figured that right. So
in terms of complying with state statute and the DNR and MPCA standards, that has not been addressed and it hasn't been taken up yet. Because
you are the RGU at this point.
Okay.
But you would fully intend to deal with the issue of the trout stream question,
everything.
Obviously, because
yes.
it is now in statute.
Right. Well, for silica sand mining anyway.
Correct.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the
Commissioner Landwehr.
Decision as to whether or not a permit is needed for the trout stream setback is not up to the county. It's up to the department.
It would move on to the DNR. And
it is in your department's
yes,
hands.
Yes, exactly.
Absolutely.
Right. And they have to meet all those conditions with all state agencies.
Commissioner Thompson.
Commissioner.
Not yet, Mr. Chair.
He's working on that.
Could call you senator or something.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves. Kate, could you do me a favor? And on the screen, you had a definition on the mandatory categories. And maybe it was just EIS and I'm remembering it incorrectly. But if EAW was in there, when it had the 2013 legislation that identified specifically silica sand, because there just seems, at least for me, and I'm hoping I'm not the only one who has this question, the definition on silica sand, is it the source material or is it the intended use? And maybe by raising this question, I'm opening a whole new can of worms, but I'm just curious on that because the EAW threshold's there. 40 acres to a mean depth of 10 plus feet. And then we have, you know, the fourth bullet, which identifies legislation regarding silica sand facilities. And I don't know if anybody here can provide insight into the definition of silica sand. Is it the source material? Is it the...
Mr. Williams is jumping up and down there. Come on up, David.
What makes him a professional?
Yeah.
You're welcome to come up and also testify, Mr. Erickson. So
I'm David Williams again. The definition of silica sand is contained within the 2013 legislation itself. It tells you that it is a high quartz mineral, and it goes on further to describe what silica sand is. Silica sand is what Mr. Erickson has as his mining site. And so the legislation contemplates not what the end use of the mineral is going to be. It really focuses on the mining activity. The legislature didn't care whether silica sand coming from Mr. Erickson's site was going to be used to do a bridge, to frack a mine, or to make granola or ice cream. It doesn't matter. It is silica sand, and that's exactly what silica sand is. It's a mineral.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Mr. Erickson, please.
I would like to add to that there's silica in every piece of dirt in this state, every rock, and every other mineral. There's silica. So the definition of silica is so broad that we would not be able to pinpoint that here today.
All right. Thank you very much for both of your comments. Other questions?
Just, Mr. Chair, perhaps a question for staff. I just wanted to be clear. Right. I'm looking at this. I looked at this earlier, and I think I made the correct conclusion, but I'd like it to be reaffirmed by staff. Due to the size of the Erickson mine, there's nothing in the newly legislated categories that require an EAW for this mine to continue.
Kate?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, ultimately the RGU is required to review the thresholds, and remember those are for mandatory reviews, but any projects that are determined to be beneath the threshold of the mandatory review and yet above the threshold of the exemption would still apply for any discretionary reviews that an RGU wanted to move forward with. So you're right, the numbers seem clear that 19.11 is still below 20, but that does not eliminate the potential for a discretionary review.
And the discretionary review would be called by the RGU.
Correct. So if that were determined, as I said, the mandatory categories also identify the RGUs. And so in this case, it's the local government unit. If that local government unit determined that because of the nature of this project, there was a need for a discretionary environmental review, regardless of that size, well, as long as it's not an exempt project, then that project could be done, an environmental review could be done, an EAW specifically.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, was it staff's assertion or was it the zoning administrator's comment? This is the smallest of 140, what was it, 140 similar situated mines in the county? Was that a correct statement that I heard?
The EQB staff did not make that assertion. You can certainly ask those.
Okay. The zoning administrator is indicating that he made that statement.
Thank you. Other questions? If not, I'd like to, first of all, thank you, Chairperson Walters, for coming up and participating in the process. Kate, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this is for staff, I think. So we've been focusing on the Minnesota Sands and the Erickson's, the dissolution of their business relationship. And I guess I hadn't thought of it from the – so is the perspective of our phased action or – The EIS that we made ourselves the RGU for last year, is the focus of that, is it that we're responsible for the EIS in the named mines, basically, or anything that Minnesota Sand puts forward? And I guess I'm struggling with that. So it's basically we're focusing on the dissolution of Erickson's from Minnesota Sands. And is that the question when trying to answer the question before us? Or is it the question that we said we're the RGU for these separate mines who are brought together by Minnesota Sands? Am I being clear on that question?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, your legal counsel might be able to answer that. It would be helpful.
Okay. Hi. I would say that because if you look to the findings of fact that you have from March 20th, 2013, they'd say in the matter of the requests, okay, sorry, this is the current one. If you look to the one that was done in March 20th, 2013, it says, in the matter of request to designate a different responsible governmental unit for environmental review of multiple silica sand projects proposed by Minnesota Sands LLC in Fillmore, Houston, and Waconia counties. At the time of that, they listed out projects including the Erickson Mine. So the findings of fact that this board entered at that time was based on the information this board had at that time. Now we're coming into new time. It appears that the findings were about Minnesota Sands, mm-hmm. and that was the key. That was the key proposer of that, not these individual mine sites. They were mentioned because they were trying to determine whether or not, I think, thresholds will be done, what you as a board would be looking at in terms of redesignating the RGU, what would make the most sense. So it was providing you information. But it wasn't saying for the Erickson mine or for the Jones mine or for the Smith mine. There was never that level of detail. So I think looking back in that and reading the findings, I would say that it deals with whether or not, I think the question before you that staff started with, which is whether or not the Tracy Michelle Erickson mine property of 19.11 acres, specifically in Houston County, whether that parcel piece mine is a related or is a phased action to Minnesota Sands and all of their multi-county projects that they have under the one umbrella, Minnesota Sands, Minnesota Prop, and LLP. I hope that provides clarity.
Well, it does provide clarity, I think, but it also provides a significant amount of confusion also, because if that is the case and you're dealing with Minnesota Sands, then what are we doing here today? We should be just waiting for Minnesota Sands to submit the list of sites that would be considered phased and connected, and if Erickson Mine is not in that list, then they'd be out of the list, wouldn't they? Or any others that would not be submitted with the list that Erickson or that Minnesota Sands is submitting.
Mr. Chair, yes, in my view, I am being asked of a set of unknown size, of unknown places, to declare that a known place is not a part of the set of what might be known.
Proving the negative, in other words.
I have a hard time making a decision in that light, because I don't know when I'll make the other decision, and I'm interested in making that other decision. I want to know what we're going to do.
So,
and I think the people who live in the area want to be served by this board's actions, not. And I understand Mr. Erickson's plight. I just am not happy that we don't have a cost agreement. We are not discussing the scope of the EIS rather than the scope of the not EIS.
I agree.
That's perfectly clear.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think staff guidance on phased and connected actions is where we should focus our energies rather than on what we don't know. In what may happen in the future, the definitions of phased and connected actions provide clear guidance. I believe that's why those that language was installed.
Mr. Chair, members of the board,
okay.
Because the Minnesota Sands multi-site EIS was initially defined as multiple phased actions to exceed that threshold, we felt that it was appropriate to revisit those same concepts. So I hope that was helpful and not more confusing.
Mr. Chair, I have a related question, and that is, Kate, when this EIS goes forward, I know it's one of the prime duties of the EIS and the RGU to define the project, the potential areas of impact. is, would the project, looking at it purely from an environmental perspective or primarily from an environmental perspective, would the EQB EIS be prohibited from scoping anything that is not named by Mr. Frick as one of his projects? Would, when the EIS goes to look at cumulative impacts, can it only look at cumulative impacts that might be related to those specific sites? Is there anything broader that happens in the EIS process? Or are we basically doing EISs for his help? Say there is a trout stream issue that the expertise of the EQB comes up with, and it's more complicated, the trout streams, or some of the potential impacts are more complicated, and they might involve other could they involve anything other than those sites that Mr. Frick is naming as his sites? Can the EIS scope and examine impacts from anything other than those specific sites that he names?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, I will attempt to answer that.
Okay. If it's not a question that's answerable, don't try. Sure. Just say it's not answerable.
Let's take a step back and talk again about cumulative potential effects. Cumulative potential effects are an analysis that need to be done as part of any environment's review and should be considered. As I said, EQB staff believes that it's on an impact-by-impact, case-by-case basis. So for an EIS, it should, as part of the review, review those resources, whether they be water resources or air resources, within the context of existing projects, as well as for future projects where the expectation has been laid within that environmentally relevant area. And again, the environmentally relevant area could be broader for certain types of effects, such as water resources, mm-hmm. or it could be more limited, such as traffic resources or traffic impacts. So a cumulative potential effects analysis occurs within that review. But a project, of course, is defined by a project proposer because they, of course, are the one proposing said project.
That's clear.
All right, we're going to have to roll on here a little bit in a few minutes, but Commissioner Rothman.
Yeah, just I don't know if this muddies the water any further or not.
Probably does.
or makes it even clearer. It seems to be generally that there's a few conditions that are still unsettled and things are happening. The one question that I have with respect to which comes first, the permitting process or the decision of the RGU, and just to put this out there, I mean, I feel some responsibility with the EQB being the RGU that we have some stewardship over making an appropriate decision. So that's why all these questions. And then one that stuck in my mind that came up from some of the testimony was this, and maybe staff knows the answer, is if we were to postpone the decision on whether or not to, on the RGU, you know, either to complete the permitting process or to figure out what the scoping is of this project, and with the postponement of that RGU decision, say later we do decide, no, Erickson is out, and the permitting process in Houston had occurred, what happens then? Would Houston go through the RGU at that point after the fact, or had the permitting process already been completed?
Well,
or
if we acted on it, we would remove ourselves as the RGU for the Erickson mine. Be the RGU.
My question is then, does the RGU status go back to Houston, and would it be after the permitting process that
they've gone? For that specific mine, yes.
And does Houston expect then, even if they go through the decisions on the permitting tomorrow night or whatever, to consider the status of this and to go?
You did hear from the chair, and the chair said yes, they'll consider. I believe I'm paraphrasing what you said. I am, but I mean, I think it's accurate. You said, of course, we'll. Consider all of those conditions.
Take action as the RGU and go through the process that we already require by our ordinance with instructions
in. Is that?
I just want to make sure.
Water?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I also wanted to reiterate
Yep, go ahead.
Reiterate for the record that the Planning Commission meets tomorrow night. That doesn't automatically renew the permit. Planning Commission takes up their and makes a recommendation to the county board, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, that is correct if the county's the RGU.
Brian.
Yep.
Mr. Chair?
Please come on up to the microphone. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to see you here. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is John Dustman. I'm a principal of Summit Enviro Solutions, a consulting firm here in St. Paul. And hopefully, Mr. Commissioner Stein, I can help you with some of your questions. The number of sites to bring forward in an EIS is obviously a very complicated issue for a business entity that is about to embark on something of this size. And the business climate, the economic climate, the political climate, all weigh factors. And Minnesota Sands has obviously been in a very tough position. When I got a call the day that somebody heard that the governor was going to ban frac sand mining in the state of Minnesota, somebody quoted him at the state fair. Well, obviously, that would weigh into somebody's decision to move forward with an endeavor to do an EIS. A year ago, there was talk about a statewide EIS. Again, that has to be weighed. If the state were going to jump in and do a statewide EIS, why would a project proposer take on probably what's going to be close to $2 million to do an EIS? In what counties? Counties that have moratoriums, counties that don't have moratoriums, counties that have moratoriums but extend the moratoriums, counties that are really in somewhat of a turmoil. And so we've kind of been advising Minnesota Sands all along. We got involved fairly late in the game. We actually drilled the borings at the sites in Houston County and kind of tried to characterize the resource that was there in addition to the dolomite that's obviously been mined at these sites that we're talking about. I'm not sure the board understands that. These are existing quarries that have been. So when we advised Minnesota Sands to go ahead and do a voluntary EIS, it was because we didn't feel, based on our experience, that it would be successful in the Yoder and Dobbelstein issues, that they would be considered connected actions. It would increase, put them over the threshold, and that ultimately, after lots of wrangling and legal maneuvering, that it would be required anyway. With what was going on in Houston County, with permitted facilities, certainly Minnesota Sands didn't feel like they were going to be doing EISs on mines that already had permits. They were quarries, had been for years. The permits did not distinguish between dolomite and sand. And so they thought they were going to be able to generate a revenue source to fund the EIS by mining in Houston County. Hence the lawsuits that were going back and forth with Houston County, can permits revoked or temporary suspended? Not real sure. We're certainly not attorneys and have not gotten involved in any of that. So then we decided, well, you know, if you're going to do this, Mr. Frick gets calls every day. Well, that might be an exaggeration. Maybe not a year ago. He gets calls all the time from people, landowners, who have this resource underneath their property. And why don't you throw my property into the EIS? And so when we met with Mr. Smizer and Ms. Hallback in my office in March of 2013, which had to have been literally within a week of your findings of fact that unfortunately we weren't here. I'm not sure why, but we met with Mr. Smizer and Ms. Hallback, and we made it very clear that the EIS would depend on the cost, and it would depend on what the scope would depend on the cost. And we made it clear that conventional wisdom would say, well, let's just come back and do an EIS on Yoder and Dabbelstein, because the EIW is complete. There's 220 pages of comments, and for somebody with an environmental review and an environmental permitting background, that seems like pretty straightforward to me, and that could be done, and it certainly wouldn't cost $2 million. And so that was kind of one idea that we had on the table. At the time, Mr. Frick's business associates were making different decisions because the city of St. Charles had decided to vote down the St. Charles farm-to-rail, then sand plant transload site. And so the investors that Mr. Frick had attracted to go forward with that project decided they didn't want to be involved. So the funding source for the EA, for the EIS that he voluntarily did were no longer there. I would like for the record to note that Mr. Frick has had the income agreement for just 2 weeks longer than he waited for it. Okay, that meeting was in March. It'll be clear that meeting was in March of 2013. The income agreement was not produced to Mr. Frick until the middle of October 2013. So I guess I don't feel like there's been an inordinate amount of time that's gone by, and with the different decisions that are being made on a county-state basis, the decisions for sites to bring to the EIS still haven't been made. It's not like they're hiding anything. It's kind of a changing dynamic. And so with Houston County in particular, it was basically hedging bets, Mr. Stein, or Commissioner Stein, excuse me. It was basically hedging a bet, because if they lost in Houston County in court or whatever it was, if they weren't going to recognize the existing permits of the quarries that had been mined, then if they were part of the EIS, about a year, 14 months, whatever it is, 18 months later, at the time when those lines converged, it would be likely that those mines would have been, you know, covered under the EIS. Does that shed any light on any of this?
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Stein.
Thank you, Mr. Dustman, for stepping forward. And I appreciate the information. And I don't want to come across as argumentative, but I want to understand your relationship. So are you advising Mr. Frick and Minnesota Sands? Is that your, do you have a contract with him on that regard?
We are, yes. We are under. We have been working for Minnesota Sands for about 2.5 years now.
Thank you.
Yes.
Do you have any relationship with Mr. or Mrs. Erickson?
No.
Okay. Have you done borings on Mr. Erickson's property?
Yes, I have.
The material that he's talking about mining, is it silica material or is it dolomite?
No, it is absolutely the Jordan sandstone. It is a Cambrian sandstone.
Thank you. So it is silica, but I mean you raise the question of dolomite mining, which is used for different aggregate as a different aggregate resource, crushed rock and so forth. I just wanted to be clear on the record. And I do appreciate your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Seeing none, thank you so much for stepping forward. At this time, I'd like to ask Kelly Stank to please come on up, or as they say, come on down. Kelly, nice to see you again.
Good afternoon.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Kelly Stanage from Houston, Minnesota. And I'm here as a resident, a citizen, and I do currently serve on the Joint Agency Silica Sand Advisory Council or panel. Chair Fredrickson and members of the board, before I get into my statement, I did want to clarify one thing. Our Soil and Water Conservation District Director, Ron Miners, I'm not sure you may know him, his staff evidently did just do a survey of all the mines in Houston County, and they came up with an average size of 6.5 acres. So I just wanted to get that information out there. I think it's important. I'm very happy to see that you're giving this due diligence. I think it's very important, however, to understand the context. You're getting some of it, and I'm happy to see that. But this is obviously a complex issue that spans multiple authorities and has occurred over a couple of years now. My statement is intended to provide that context in order to aid you in making an informed decision. The Erickson site has been an occasionally used borrow pit in Houston County, as you've learned, for which a CUP was originally granted in 1992, and it was approved for 8,000 to 10,000 cubic yards of sand. And you see that in the J. Squires letter that's been referenced a couple times. Tracy Erickson purchased the property in December of 2009. And at some point after that, he apparently formed a business relationship with Minnesota Sands to mine silica sand from the old borrow pit. In June of 2012, G-Cubed, an engineering firm hired by Minnesota Sands, prepared an operations and reclamation plan for the silica sand mine. The estimated amount of silica sand to be mined was over 2 million cubic yards. That original 2012 plan with the cover letter from G-Cube starts on page 11 of the additional materials in your board packet. It was the packet that was sent out later. The Houston County Board of Commissioners issued a moratorium on silica sand mining in February of 2012. Minnesota Sands and Tracy Erickson came to some conclusion that the moratorium did not apply to them and began excavation at the site in July of that year. On July 10th, 2012, the county board issued a stop work order. Minnesota Sands and Tracy Erickson subsequently filed a lawsuit seeking, among other things, a temporary injunction to lift the stop work order. A citizen's petition for an EAW on the Erickson mine only, it was only on the Erickson mine, was submitted and approved by the EQB in August of 2012. The Houston County Board officially ordered the EAW that August. Erickson's and Minnesota Sands' request for an injunction was denied in November of 2012. The judge's memorandum, which is on page 72 of your packet, also noted that the more limited mining, which had gone on since 1992, could not proceed until the moratorium was lifted. In March of 2013, the EQB took on the RGU status for the 11 silica sand mines proposed by Minnesota Sands in Winona, Fillmore, and Houston counties. Attorney Jay Squire's letter to Zoning Administrator Scanlon indicated that the CUP for the Erickson mine had expired in early 2013, and the expiration date has been mentioned as January of 2013. Since then, the EQB, as you've been discussing, has attempted to finalize a scoping phase of the multi-site EIS. Meanwhile, you've received numerous correspondence from several people, Jed Hommel, Rick Frank, Bob Scanlon, claiming that the business relationship has been dissolved. Jeff Smizer asked some good questions about that business relationship, which have not been answered in writing. And I think it's important to get answers to those questions. Dissolution of contract agreement, which was penned evidently in September of 2012, it identifies several conditions that Commissioner Rothman had pointed out that must be met in order to achieve the dissolution of the business relationship. Point six of that agreement indicates Minnesota Sands will pay all attorney's fees to obtain Erickson's existing permit back. That same existing permit, which Attorney Jay Squires had indicated was expired, it also further stipulates what the terms of that permit should be, making a distinction between sand and, quote, not frack sand, and that the permit term shall be consistent with what Erickson had prior to the lease agreement. Point nine indicates that the parties will release and forever discharge each other from any and all claims in exchange for the aforementioned consideration. The fact is that the exchange for the aforementioned consideration has not occurred. Therefore, the actual dissolution has not occurred. They have agreed to the terms of the dissolution, but they've not yet dissolved the relationship because the terms have not been met. I also question whether the terms of the agreement can legally be met. Given the fact that the permit is expired, it should require a new permit. There is an outstanding citizen-petitioned EAW on that specific site. There is new legislation regarding silica sand mining. We have also established that this is silica sand at this site, and a judge's ruling stated mining could not take place until after the moratorium was lifted. I would argue that there may well be, and certainly should be, additional conditions on any CUP that may be issued. In addition, according to the operation and reclamation plan, in your original packet forwarded to Carolyn Magnuson of the EQB by Bob Scanlon on May 7th of 2014, the scope of the project, according to the operations map, is the same as the proposal originally submitted by G-Cubed in June of 2012. The document you received from Scanlon is the same document as originally proposed by Minnesota Sands with manual handwritten alterations to distances and entire sections including dust mitigation, safety fencing, and safety having apparently been manually blanked out. Several attachments from the June 2012 plan, which included a stormwater prevention plan, have also been omitted from the document sent by Scanlon. In addition, in the document submitted by Scanlon on May 7th, the excavation quantities on page 111 of your packet have been whited out. If you look at the excavation quantities on that same operations map in the additional packet, it indicates the excavation of 2,323,225 cubic yards. The project described in this document is over 200 times larger than the 8 to 10,000 cubic yards per year borrow pit originally permitted. So in summary, my points are, the terms of the dissolution of the business relationship have not been met, which means that the business relationship has not been dissolved. Until then, the Erickson site should remain included in the multi-site EIS. This is a new, dramatically larger project. It is not the same as the originally permitted borrow pit. This appears to be an attempt to circumvent currently ordered environmental review as well as new legislation passed last year. If you intend for the new silica sand mining legislation to have any teeth at all, I respectfully suggest that you insist on follow-through for environmental review, trout stream permit setback permits, and any other relevant regulation for this project. Thank you for the time to speak.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Stanage. I botched your name again. I do it all of the time, so. I'd like to ask Marilyn Fraukenkorn, Bayer, and Joanna Rupert to come up.
They were giggling.
I kind of botched those up too, didn't I?
Hoping there's some Fredricksons in the audience.
Yep. Yeah. Well, okay. I think I nailed Joanna's name. I think I got that one down, yeah. So, welcome. Close, yeah, sure. Welcome, both of you, to the committee. And please identify yourself for the record.
Happy to, sir.
Clearly.
My name is Marilyn Fraukenkorn-Bayer.
That's what I said.
All right, well said. Good afternoon. Mr. Chair and members of the board, thank you for this opportunity to address the Environmental Quality Board. My name is Marilyn Fraukenkorn-Bayer, as we just established, and I am a lifelong resident of Houston County, whose family first settled there in 1866. So seven subsequent generations of my family have chosen to call Houston County home. We, along with all Land Stewardship Project members, are greatly concerned about Minnesota Sands Environmental Impact Statement issue to be taken up at your meeting here today. The decision the Environmental Quality Board makes here regarding the Erickson Sand and Minnesota Sands LLC Environmental Impact Statement has far-reaching repercussions for the health of the land and the health of the people in southeastern Minnesota, as well as the integrity of the environmental review process. The operator of the Erickson mine now claims he is producing construction sand, not frack sand. We have established that sand is silica sand. On a side, I do hold a degree in geology, and no, not all rocks in Minnesota have silica in them. However, the proposed plans for the new operation are in essence identical to the frac sand operation proposal. Back in June of 2012, a company called G-Cube submitted permit application documents for the original frac sand mine proposed for the Erickson property. The documents in your EQB board packet appear to be the same documents with a new title page and certain portions manually masked out. For example, under the access heading on the second page, the old plan calls for dust mitigation on the access road, and the document in your packet does not include that point, but the space where it would have been is still there. The operations map is exactly the same, except the old earthworks excavation summary, previously under the legend, has been masked out. And at the bottom right corner of the page, Rick Frick has been masked out and replaced with handwritten Tracy Erickson. The area of the mine is the same. The minerals being extracted is the same. The names have been changed. Now some of the minor safeguards included in the original documents have been omitted. This looks like the same mine originally proposed. The potential for cumulative effects is still present, even more so if all the mines in Houston County are able to start mining silica sand under old permits. What would prevent Minnesota Sands LLC from starting a new LLC and entering into a new lease with the Ericksons? As I understand it, these sorts of shell games are all too common in these circles. This mine needs to stay in the ordered EIS, as the cumulative environmental impacts of the mining will be the same to southeastern Minnesota. The owner of the Minnesota Sands LLC claims he has severed ties with the Erickson mine owner and wants that mine removed from the EIS. Because of this, the EQB is considering removing the Erickson mine from the EIS. The EQB ordering the multi-site environmental statement, impact statement, and becoming the responsible government unit has been by far the most significant state action to date to protect southeastern Minnesota from frac sand mining. The EQB has the authority and the obligation to deny this attempted end run around the environmental review process. Here are the factors we believe the EQB needs to keep in mind in making the decision to keep the Erickson mine as part of the EIS. The EQB has received incomplete information about the severing of the relationship between the mine owners and Minnesota Sands LLC, Minnesota Proppant LLC, Richard Frick. Number two, according to the documents in the EQB board packet, the owners of the mine, Tracy and Michelle Erickson, have provided no information to the EQB at all prior to this meeting. All information has come from Houston County staff or Richard Frick. Number three, more troubling, is the Erickson's proposed new project for construction sand is identical to the original one to produce frac sand. It is very possible this construction sand could be sold to some new enterprise operated or controlled by Mr. Frick and then sold as frac sand. The EQB has asked for full and complete information on the relationship between the mine owner and Mr. Frick, Minnesota Sands LLC and Minnesota Proppant LLC, and has not received it. In the March 25, 2014 EQB letter to Mr. Frick, EQB staff write, quote, "Please describe in detail any association between the Tracy and Michelle Erickson site or Tracy and Michelle Erickson and Minnesota Sands LLC and or Minnesota Proppant LLC. This would include any past, current, or anticipated future associations and include but not be limited to a partnership, ownership, shareholder, buyer, seller, processor, transporter, or relationship of any kind," end quote. In a letter received by the EQB from Mr. Frick on April 5th, 2014, there was a dissolution of contract with no explanation or the accompanying documents necessary to fuller understand it, such as the original lease and or the original agreement. As my grandfather used to say, there's something rotten in Denmark and it isn't the cheese. To the citizens watching this issue, it just does not pass our olfactory sensory test about this being a different proposal, nor about ensuring the relationship between Minnesota Sands LLC and the Ericksons is severed. The fact is, there is a lack of information despite the clear request from the EQB for more detailed information. There is a process for a variance from the environmental review process spelled out in rules. This process allows for public input and requires more detailed information from the proposer. This is the process which needs to be followed for the mining of silica sand at the site before the EIS is completed. The provisions for the variance are found in Minnesota Rule 4410.3100, subpart 4, 5, and 6. These provisions require, among other things, information about the anticipated environmental effects of undertaking the proposal. how approval would affect the purpose of environmental review and public notice and comment. If an EQB order to remove the Erickson mine from the EIS would move forward at some time, despite the above facts, the order needs to state, number one, a silica sand trout stream setback permit is required. Number two, a previously started EAW on the mine must be completed. And number three, the RGU for the environmental assessment worksheet will be the DNR. If the decision is made, the Erickson mine is no longer part of the EIS, the issue cannot properly just be handed back to Houston County. This proposed mine is within a mile of a trout stream and will require a DNR-issued silica sand trout stream setback permit to operate. The sand available at this site is silica sand, and calling it construction sand does not change this fact. There was an EAW in process when the Erickson mine was included in the EIS. That EAW still must be completed if the mine is removed from the EIS. While Houston County was named the RGU for the EAW at that time, the new requirement for a silica sand trout stream setback permit should require the DNR to be the RGU for the EAW as well. The importance of this decision cannot be overemphasized for the people of southeastern Minnesota. If the EQB simply allows the Erickson mine out of the EIS, then it is creating a blueprint for the other mines in the EIS to do the same thing. We urge you to reject this obvious attempt to circumvent this much-needed environmental review. Thank you again for this opportunity to address the Environmental Quality Board. Good day.
Thank you very much. I think we'll just go to Joanna, and then if you have questions, if you wouldn't mind just hanging in there,
yes.
And if you have questions, we'll take questions for both of you. Thank you. Joanna.
All right. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Johanna Ruprecht. I'm an organizer with Land Stewardship Projects based in our Lewiston office in southeast Minnesota. First of all, I'm just passing out copies of the letter which was sent from the DNR in April to Mr. Erickson regarding the requirement for a silica sand trout stream setback permit at the site. Just would like to make sure you all have a copy of that. I don't believe it was in your packet. And then next, I'd like to make sure you're all aware of a little bit of the history of environmental review with the proposed Minnesota Sands project overall. What we've seen in the last couple of years is really a piecemeal approach and an attempt to avoid any EIS requirement on this project, in spite of how clear it is and has been that the phased action rule does apply to what Minnesota Sands is doing. We've seen in Winona County in 2012, the Yoder and Dobbelstein mines, which are proposed there by Minnesota Sands, they put those through separate EAW processes and claimed that the landowners, the Yoder and the Dobbelstein families, were the proposers. They did not identify themselves, Minnesota Sands, as the proposer in that EAW process, basically in an attempt to show that they were not phased actions. They also, in those EAW documents, claimed that there was no relationship between the mines and Minnesota Proppant, proposing the frac sand processing plant in St. Charles, which was also not true. And it took extensive citizen organizing to get to the point that it became clear, yes, these are phased actions, and yes, Minnesota Sands is proposing phased actions that add up to well over the mandatory EIS threshold of 160 acres. They actually, the 11 sites, which is the only list we have now, that's the list we have to go on until and unless anything else is submitted. The 11 sites in your original order from March 20th, 2013, for the EIS total 615 acres. So that is well, well above the 160 acre mandatory EIS threshold for sand mining. So for the proposers to refer to this as a voluntary EIS, you don't get to volunteer to do something that's mandatory. If you're proposing over 160 acres of sand mining, even if it's at multiple sites in the same environmentally relevant area, those are phased actions. That's a mandatory EIS. So that's what we're dealing with here, and that has not changed. Again, the only list we have is those 11 sites, 615 acres. However, if you were to receive a new list without Houston County mines, which has been referred to as a possibility today, the Winona and Fillmore County sites within that original list still total well over 250 acres. It would still be a mandatory EIS that we're talking about. But again, it wasn't. It took substantial work on the part of citizens to get to the point where that law was being enforced and that the EIS was originally ordered. So I think what we're seeing here today is a continuation of that pattern of behavior of attempting to circumvent environmental review, and I'm very concerned about that, and I think you should be aware of that and concerned as well, just because of that history. Secondly, I'd also just like to make sure you are aware and are keeping in mind how high the level of citizen interest and concern is in this issue in southeast Minnesota, in Winona, Houston, and Fillmore counties, in the areas that would be directly impacted by this proposed project. You may remember last September, I shared with you copies of a document, the People's EIS Scoping Report, which LSP compiled from the comments that we received at a meeting we held last July in Rushford, Minnesota. We had 100 people packed into a church hall there. It's really the central to the area in which these proposed mines are located. People are very, very concerned about the impacts of this project on their lives and their homes and their communities. So please keep that in mind as you make any decisions about this issue. And that document is on our website. I encourage you to take a look at it again. It's called the People's EIS Scoping Report. Thirdly, then, I want to reemphasize what you've heard about already, that you asked for more information on this situation from the project proposers. You very clearly made that request, and you have not received it. All you've received in writing was a dissolution of contract without the original contract or lease agreement or really anything else to put that in context. And it's interesting that that dissolution document is dated September of 2013. It was not brought before you for many months after that. And now the parties involved are saying, you know, you really can't wait any longer. We've had to wait too long. Well, they were waiting for some reason during that time. And so, again, you really don't have the information before you. A lot of this seems to be on a verbal-only basis. There just isn't enough information before you as far as documentation to be able to make a decision today that this project should be removed from the EIS. And so I would urge you not to make that decision today. However, if that is the road that you go down, there is still, as you've heard from several other people, there is still a requirement for an EAW on the Erickson project, which was citizen petition. It was ordered by Houston County. And I'd like to draw your attention once more to the letter from the attorney, Mr. Squires, in your packet from May of 2013. He says, the county board determined in its findings and EAW decision that any mining at the site required completion of an EAW. That determination was never challenged. Thus, in my opinion, the final action prohibition would apply in this case, and Erickson would not be allowed to mine until the EAW is complete. So, and this is their attorney's recommendation, it does not make any reference to Minnesota Sands or any relationship or lack thereof. It says any mining at the site. I don't really see how that could be any clearer that it is. And again, this was an EAW that was ordered by Houston County after a citizen petition. There isn't a mechanism in the rules that Houston County can just change their mind and say, we take it back and we unorder it. It was ordered. That requirement still stands, even if the Erickson mine were to be removed from the EIS, which I would urge you not to do. However, if that happens, they are still under that standing EAW order. All right, thank you. Any questions?
Thanks, Joanna. Questions for either testifiers? Commissioner Landwehr?
Not so much a question, but, you know, I'm not a geologist, but I want to go back to the fundamental. We have a statutory definition of what silica sand is, and just to paraphrase a couple things, it's well-rounded sand-sized grains of quartz, silicon dioxide, with very little impurities in terms of other minerals, but it also specifically does not include common rock, stone, aggregate, gravel, sand with low quartz level or silica compounds recovered as a byproduct of metallic mining. So it's very specific to a type of sand. And that's, you know, I think to Commissioner Stein's question, that's what we find in that deposit.
All right. I think we're getting close. Other questions for either Joanna or Elizabeth? Or Marilyn, I'm sorry. Yeah. Let's close.
You're having a rough day.
I am having a rough day, yeah. None? Hearing none or seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you again.
For your
thank
comments.
You.
I think we're getting close. Remember, I believe Kate pointed out we have four options in front of us. One of them is to adopt a resolution removing the Erickson mine from the phased and connected status. The other one is to amend and adopt. The other would be to table, no action, and, oh, there it is, okay, and or reject. So that's where we're at.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
I'm going to move that we table action on this. until the next meeting. And I don't want this to come as a signal that we're not interested in making a decision. I'm interested in making a decision. I'm interested in the consequences to the landowners and to the county. However, the information we heard today was the first we've heard answers to some questions. I appreciate that from the owners. I do believe that a more affirmative statement from Mr. Frick regarding his intentions, he stated today that he does not intend to complete or have any projects in Houston County, and something describing that determination would be very helpful to have in writing before we take action. And I believe that even if the cost agreement and the scoping process has not begun, that kind of correspondence would be very useful for the board to have, and it would just set everyone on the same understanding before this property is determined to be outside the scope of a potential EIS. And I explained my reasoning for being frustrated, and I appreciate the board's indulgence. But with that, Mr. Chair, I move that we table action on this until the June board meeting.
You have heard the motion. It does require a second. However, it is not debatable. So is there a second to the motion to table? Is there a second to the motion?
Mr. Chair, I'll second.
There is a second. I wonder if we should. Yeah, we'll have a roll call vote. I'll ask Executive Director Seufert to call the roll.
Chairman Fredrickson?
No.
Commissioner Clark Steven? Oh, excuse me. Ms. Idy Tollefson?
Yes.
Commissioner Ellinger?
No.
Ms. Gehring?
Yes.
Ms. Knuth?
Yes.
Commissioner Lamware?
No.
Commissioner Napstad?
No.
Commissioner Rothman?
Yes.
Mr. Saxog?
No.
Commissioner Stein?
Yes.
Mr. Tomlinson?
Yes.
Commissioner Zelli?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, did Commissioner Cronk vote?
It's a majority, 7-5. It is a majority.
7-5 to table.
Yeah, the motion is 7-5. To table. So the motion prevails. Thank you. The motion is laid on the table. We will move then to the next item of business. I'm sorry.
Just a closing observation. You know, that in this very controversial area, there are going to be strong positions on both sides. It's absolutely critical that there be good public process and public documentation. And I'm not seeing the good public documentation that the CUP was extended uninterrupted. And so I think we're going to have to make sure, and I'm going to throw that back to the county, that the county needs to provide that documentation, that there is not a lapse in the permit. And it's perhaps not so much a discussion or consideration for this discussion, but at this point in time, it would be my belief that a trout stream setback would be needed if any sand would be extracted. But I think the other element at question is whether or not the EAW is still the petition for the EAW, the requirement for the EAW is still standing, which everything I've seen suggests it is. And again, there are specific actions that need to be taken to start an EAW. There are specific actions that need to be done to deny an EAW. One of that, for instance, includes publication in the EQB Monitor. We have not had a request to publish an EQB Monitor. So the county has not followed the letter of the law and the rules, if that is, in fact, the position of the county and the other folks. So I just want to stress that it's going to be incredibly important when we get into this very contentious regulatory legal process that we have a good public record. And I don't think we have that before us today.
All right. And again, I want to thank all of you for taking the time to participate in this 2.5-hour discussion. It's been, I think, highly educational, and we have really tried very hard to focus on the facts. So thank you very much. Kate?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, the next item on our agenda is in reference to the Minnesota River Integrated Watershed Study. This is the ongoing study with that's co-sponsored between the Environmental Quality Board and the Army Corps of Engineers, and we'll kind of let things settle a little bit before I hand it over to Jason. But we're lucky enough to have with us today Jason Smith, who's with the Army Corps of Engineers. He's out of the Rock Island office, and so he will be talking us through some of the recent updates to the project and some of our milestones to date. So with that, if we have order again in here, I will hand it over to Jason.
Thanks, Kate. Thanks to the EQB board for having me in. I've cleared many a room before, but never quite like that. So go ahead, and that's a pretty tough act to follow, some real challenges with that issue. So hopefully we're going to go ahead and give you some highlights of the great work that all of your agencies have been doing as a part of an interagency partnership and framework here to improve the Minnesota River Basin. As you may recall, we met last I did come before the board just briefly in July, and we had a more detailed discussion within a subcommittee last summer. And so hopefully there's some base knowledge from that. I'm going to try and concentrate at a fairly high level and cruise through kind of the boring stuff. We've been doing these activities, and then I'm going to dig into some of the products, because if I always come back and stay at a high level, and you're going to ask, well, what the heck are they doing the rest of the time? So we're going to get into some products, and to the extent I get too detailed, feel free to back me out, and if you'd like to dig into more details, feel free to inquire further. So with that, this is just logo showing the basin and the partnership there. The Corps, of course, is the federal entity, and the EQB board is the non-federal sponsor as a part of the cost-sharing agreement. General purpose here is to develop an integrated watershed plan that really brings together these local, state, and federal entities towards a concentrated and a consensus and a uniform vision for how to manage the watershed. A little bit of a funny story. There's within the Army, there's the Chief of Engineers, and it's a position that was appointed by George Washington, identifying the importance of having an engineer to manage fortifying defenses and stand-up development. And we had the benefit of having, not the current one, but a couple years ago, a gentleman came, and the Chief Engineer said he had a colleague in NASA, and when we had a mission to put someone on the moon, he said everyone from the janitor to the director knew that was the mission. That was the man on the moon mission. So we've been having a lot of tough discussions over the last year of, you know, watershed scale, there's lots of efforts. What is our man on the mission? And really two primary points fleshed out as part of that. One, it's a technical modeling exercise. We're bringing capacity and capability with technical modeling tools that don't currently exist within other capacities, or in a way that we're able to explore information in a new way. The other product is that this is an integrated water resources management. So the information that is currently available is oftentimes developed and for a specific purpose with a specific interest area. So what we want to do is, part of telling the whole watershed story is there's trade-offs that are occurring, right? As you optimize or you improve one thing, then you're potentially giving up something else. So those are the two main pieces. Bottom line, there's two products. There's a watershed plan, and then we want to have that be dynamic. So there's a visualization platform, a decision support system tool. And that's where we combine those data and models and information. I think most of the agency folks are standing up some sort of a DSS in these current times, so you're probably familiar with that. So there's been a question as we've been talking with local entities, well, where do you fit in with the RAPS process, with the One Watershed, One Plan? And we have a general awareness of those efforts, and I'm not going to speak exactly to where we fit within those. I will offer that in June 23rd, we're going to have a concentrated sit-down with those parties, and we're going to create a Venn diagram to really be explicit about which products each specific effort is developing and how it contributes to the broader understanding in the basin. So that's something that's...
I love that's Venn diagrams.
Yay! All right. Got a fan of Venn diagram. So within these two areas that I mentioned earlier, the technical modeling and then the integrated, the IWRM for short, we have some specific activities that have taken place. One of them is hydrologic modeling, primarily in small basins that we've identified that had a wealth of data and information, and those efforts continue to progress. There's been geomorphic assessments in those basins in order to start making those connections between hydrologic changes and geomorphic changes, and that hopefully is helping us inform what's happening with the broader system, not just these small basins. Hydraulic modeling on the lower Minnesota River, some of the feedback we heard through the process was that especially in this lower part of the Minnesota River, it would really be nice to have an improved Heckgrass model so that you could have some real-time flow forecasting and some more capabilities associated with flood risk in particular. But those also there's also other purposes, but this we are leveraging some other core project funds through a Silver Jackets pilot, so I just want to make the board aware that we are doing the best we can to leverage funds from other projects, because there is similarity and crossover with furthering some of these advancements. Study activities within this, how do we pull all the pieces together? I gave a charge to our team to say, let's get really aggressive at getting the researching what's the conditions that are out there now. What has everybody done within the organizations? How can we take advantage of the tools, the data, the information that's already been developed by the various agencies? And there is a lot. I also work in Iowa in a watershed, the Iowa Cedar, and I will say that Minnesota has some of the most robust tools and some of the most forward-thinking watershed planning perspectives and within your agencies that I've seen probably within the Midwest, so kudos to you guys. We've also been developing a communication plan, and as a part of that, we're scoping for a couple of civic engagement processes where we're proposing to do a series of workshops where we'd ask people their goals, what they think the problems are, who they think the contributor is, you know, what would success look like, those kind of things, and then matching up some technical modeling products and then having a discussion. If you could optimize a watershed plan, what would that look like? And hopefully arriving at a plan that we could maybe not optimize one interest or another, but we could reach consensus on. And that's, of course, you bring in all those different values together, so it becomes a real exercise in conflict resolution, but also can be really valuable. I've written IWR next to that, developing a communication plan, because that's another opportunity where we successfully competed for a pilot project, and we've gained facilitation and support through the Corps Institute for Water Resources, which is their research arm. And so we do have that extra capacity of that professional that comes and has been very active in the basin with us. We've been working on developing alternative landscapes, and the purpose for that is because you have to have a common platform in order to understand maybe the implications of different land use choices. If everyone's trying to say, well, I'd really like to see this scenario, I'd really like to see that scenario, you can quickly get at 50 or 100 scenarios, and it's just not practical to run through models. So we've been looking at some scenarios. I think Commissioner Stein was interested in this a year ago, and we had some examples from the Iowa Cedar Basin. As of today, they're doing quality control, quality assurance on these products for the Minnesota River Basin, so this is kind of a hot off the press sort of a product that you're seeing. Pre-European settlement, there we had a recent discussion in terms of the types of what we would be using to explore that kind of pre-European, helping us set a reference condition to say, okay, well, you know, can we get back to that level? What's practical in terms of water quality? Obviously, Minnesota means cloudy water from Native Americans. So we know that, you know, there was some sediment, there was some context to that. So trying to understand that, and it helps frame exactly where we can go. So we did arrive at a particular data set. It's a national data set, and we had a thorough discussion about the Minnesota piece. And because we went across states, there was pros and cons for different data sets. But we did arrive at one, and so we're hoping to start doing some modeling with those. And we've initiated this decision support system in terms of the conceptual framework. Anything complex like that, you can understand that there's a lot of moving parts to it. And so first of all, you have to conceptualize it. So I'm going to go ahead and dig into a couple of examples because you've heard me kind of float at a high level, and now I want to dig into a couple of products. So I'm going to just touch on one for technical modeling, and then I'm going to give you a couple of products for the IWRM because they're going to do two things. One, they're going to help you see the product that we've generated and also hopefully create a vision for where we're going. So this is the Heckgrass model, and on the right-hand side at zero would be your confluence with the Minnesota and the Mississippi River. And what we've seen is a pretty significant increase in channel width, which should be no surprise to anyone that's been down on the Minnesota River or lived the transition. But what we're kind of seeing is, and what we continue to explore now is, okay, now you've widened the channel. Well, the water that used to get up and get out now stays in the channel because it's wider and it has more capacity there. So you're actually passing more flow. So we're exploring those relationships of you add more flow so you get wider, but then you're passing more flow, so do you continue to get wider? And so we are seeing some incision as well, but I didn't include that.
I'm sorry, can I ask a question, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
So is that a annual change that this graphic is showing?
Good question. No, this is not an annual change. This is from the previous model that we had, which was a composition of cross-sections that were taken some in the 50s, the 90s. So we had kind of a cobbling. But this is the next steps for us is to take aerial imagery and try and match it with width and see if we can use that aerial image to see if there was periods of time where we saw a large change and why that may have occurred.
Thanks.
You bet.
Thanks, Jason.
So next, with the Integrated Water Resources Management, I want to talk a little bit about the framework for how we're combining our goals, objectives, and I guess what I call everything that people care about, right? So people bring with them a set of values, and they all care about different things, and they want you to evaluate it. So you have to have a framework for doing that. So for some of you that are familiar with the Watershed Health Assessment Framework, that's an index of sorts. And the idea is that you identify a main category, and then under that category, you then have specific descriptor or you have an objective. So you say, okay, well, I'm interested in hydrology. Hydrology is a general term. Well, now specifically, what are you interested in? Well, I'm interested in flow attenuation of that hydrology. Okay, well, now more specifically, what do you want to do? You want to reduce peak flows from this two-year event. Okay, now we're getting into specifics. And then you're identifying performance metrics. Okay, well, what are we saying is good? What are we saying is bad? And what are we saying is kind of in the middle? You know, and so these can be quantitative or they can be qualitative. Sometimes when they're quantitative, you'll see values be normalized, which means whatever your highest value is, you assign it a 1 or a 100, and whatever your lowest is, you assign it a 0, and everything in between falls in that range, right? So you've normalized the data set that you have. In some cases, you may be interested in a target metric. A target metric, a prime example, would be a TMDL, where you're saying we want to achieve this target of this particular constituent. And then the measurement source, of course, is where are you pulling that information from? Or is it qualitative, you know, surveys from people? Is it data? Is it model outputs? Where are you getting that info? So this is textbook. I want to dig into the Watershed Health Index or the Watershed Health Assessment Framework. There, and some of you may be familiar with these in terms of the basin ranking. You know, you have the watershed map, and you can see it's color-coded for, you know, get an A, B, C, or D? You know, how's it graded in terms of its color coding? Is it one that we need to focus on or not? What I've pulled down is the Geomorphology Health Index. But what you'll see in this section is that we just have this this kind of general category that I just mentioned. Then you have your objective or your description of, okay, what are we specifically interested in? We're interested in erosivity of the soils. And then the color-coded area, you see that this expert panel has come together and say, okay, well, what are we going to say is good and what are we going to say is not so good in terms of vulnerability? And then we're going to go ahead and assign those colors or ranges. Everybody okay with that? Okay. And then on the right-hand side, you have measurement source. This particular piece doesn't include a target, but, you know, targets can be something that are available. So once you've captured that kind of information in an index and you know you want to evaluate information, then you have to say, okay, well, we understand we want to evaluate that information, but if we can, now what are we looking at? There's a whole range of possible policy decisions, or do you base it off of optimizing for BMPs? They say, okay, we want to optimize for best management practices, but for what? Is it for the habitat? Is it for habitat? Is it for water quality? Is it for flood attenuation? Is it for geomorphology and sediment? And so what we're looking for is to generate three kind of GIS rules-based scenarios that represent a collection of best management practices on the landscape that represent dramatically different value sets. So the first scenario is really more in line with increasing the economic potential in the basin by continuing to produce more of the commodity lands, more row crops primarily. The second scenario is focused on saying, hey, our values are more centered in improving water quality, and in that way we're going to yield some of the productive row crop acreage in order to convert to pasture or something that has maybe some benefits to water quality. And the third is enhancing biodiversity that says we're really interested in the riparian corridors and the bioreserves. We're interested in this hub and corridor approach where we're assuring that there's migration routes and there's adequate habitat, but we're not totally giving up on these other aspects. So what I want to do is, and there's about 8 or 10 national data sets that these are generated from, and they include things like the wetland health inventory, the foundation's kind of soils. If they're prime soils, we assume they'll go to row crop. In some cases, if they're marginal soils, then they would go to pasture in some of these scenarios. And so they shift, and I didn't include the rules, but I'll go ahead and go into the scenarios here. So this is the reference condition. This is the base data set from 2006, and you can see that the row crops is kind of the copper color, and then your yellow and green, you got pasture and then forest, respectively. This national land cover data set does have a lot of categories. So as we move to these scenarios, some of these have been lumped together, but you can see it kind of did just give a perspective that this increasing agricultural commodity production scenario does project on the landscape quite a growth in row crop acreage. But you're still not giving up all of your riparian corridor there. Water quality, this one you're seeing more of the pasture land, and enhancing biodiversity, as I mentioned, you're seeing more of the bio the wetlands restored, you're seeing more of the riparian corridor. So now the question is, now you've got these scenarios, you've got this index, well, how do you kind of, you need some way to make a decision or support a decision across these landscapes and across these different criteria or these index points that you've identified. So what this does is we've identified five different parts within a conceptual plan. We've said hydrology is important, geomorphology is important, the habitat and wildlife are important, economics is important, water quality or nutrient loading is important. And what you see here is a kind of a hypothetical representation of what these scenarios may play out to look like, where the Future Without Project is assumed to move more towards the commodity production, where you're really maximizing the economic potential. And so just to help you understand, the zero would be the least, one would be where you're maximizing that benefit, and zero would be at the lowest value of whatever you define to be good or successful. So as you move out on the radar, then you're improving that particular condition. And so what this does is it allows you to compare trade-offs. You say, okay, if we moved more towards this kind of a landscape, then we would be gaining in water quality, but we would be giving up in this much. And then it's a point of starting the discussion of saying, is that acceptable? Is it good enough? Do you have any questions on this before I... This is really the next part of where we're working for is we've kind of laid out these in terms of a framework, and now the indices have to be populated by the respective agencies.
Mr. Chair?
Please, John.
I have a question. Mr. Smith. What are the four, or the not the four, the five corners of that star? What are those categories?
The categories are hydrologic condition, habitat, quantity and quality, geomorphic condition, economic output, and nutrient loading.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
You can't read that from here?
I can't even see it.
Yeah, I could have blown that up a little bit more. I wasn't sure. Okay, so now I've given you some idea on kind of the framework that you might have this multi-criteria decision-making platform. There are integrated models that feed into that, and there's lots of details if you want to get into it. But as far as next steps, we're completing these hydrologic modeling in the small basins. We're going to run these scenarios of these existing through the existing hydrologic, environmental, and economic models. We're going to use these as a part of conducting these civic engagement workshops, and we're going to continue work on developing that decision support system framework. So much credit to the folks at MPCA who have, at least at this point in time, indicated that they're willing to run these scenarios through the HSPF model. We think that's going to be great because it's a basin-wide model. And so the partnership really is coming together. In terms of cost share, and this is what's been committed for those over this period of time, about $2.5 million. We've been typically operating on a budget of about $350,000 on the federal side, and of course the non-federal sponsors have been meeting their obligation in work in kind. We did successfully compete for this project to be a national watershed budget pilot, which says you've been underfunding us for a long time based on our capabilities. If you gave us the right amount of money, we could get it done in a lot faster time frame. And so they said, okay, we agree with you. We're gonna increase it from $350,000 up to $900,000. So that's a success story for the progress we've been making on this project. And as I mentioned, the HSPF effort willingness to run those models would be a work in kind action. And there's a number of other things that Kate and I are working together in order to capture those, make sure the state's getting credit for the work in kind that you're doing. Partnership praise. I want to just take a minute out to, first of all, I'm impressed by Kate's ability to manage lots of different expertise because she's been very engaged with us on the communications working group as a part of the Minnesota River Study, and she clearly has her facts straight as a part of this environmental review process. So I just wanted to point out that there are people within each of your organizations that are doing a really great job, not just showing up, but showing up and contributing and continuing to be engaged. So I appreciate that. A couple, in addition to Kate, Minnesota Natural Resources there, Skip Wright and Todd Colander are both co-chairs on working groups, so they continue to be a strong presence. Greg Eggers is doing a lot of great modeling work and stays engaged. Pollution Control Agency, Larry Gunderson, Chuck Reagan, and Tim Larson. And I understand Larry Gunderson might be making a move here pretty soon, correct? He's going to the Department of Ag. So we hope to retain Larry in some capacity within the interagency framework since he has all that institutional knowledge. So, and then Department of Ag within that, Bob Patton.
Thank you for informing.
Been great.
So. One big happy family,
Dave. Is this the first time you're hearing about
yeah,
that?
Yeah,
sorry about
know,
it.
I'm used to the last of
so,
them.
Bob,
same here.
Bob Patton's really great in had in serving his capacity with the EQB, and so I know you guys are all familiar with him, but we appreciate his insight, and he's always wanted to give us the honest truth. So we need to face those hard
things. Back there smiling.
Is he? That's because he knows he gives us the hard questions now and again, and we need them, so we appreciate his involvement. And that's all I have for you. Welcome any questions that you
Jason,
have.
Jason, thank you very much. And you came all the way from Rock Island today?
Well, I live in Rock Island, but the way that we function is regionally, so I handle projects from St. Louis up to St. Paul, and so Upper Mississippi River, and so, yeah, we came
you
up for
found
the
yourself
center
in
agency
the Twin Cities today. So, well, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for being here today. Questions for Jason Smith?
Mr. Chair.
Brian.
I found your map interesting of the land use activities in those areas where you pointed out all the copper coloration. There you go. That's current land use, correct?
This one is the current. This one's the current.
Right. I find that interesting because I'm from the Mississippi River Basin, but more particularly the Upper Mississippi River Basin. And I find us to be a world of opposites from the Minnesota River Basin. Our water clarity is completely opposite from the Minnesota River water clarity. Our land use, our forests are completely opposite. I mean, where you have row crop, we have forest.
Okay.
Where this has forest, well, we don't have much row crop. But I think the land use activity we see in the upper basin, the fact that it's forested, natural peatlands, natural wetlands, natural this, of course, yield that water quality. And the land use activity here is netting the water quality that we're seeing. You pointed out three land use scenarios or three future scenarios, improve economic development, more cropping, essentially, I think you said. And you had a couple other scenarios. My question is there an option out there that nets both? In other words, isn't there some way we can look at land not as single-use land but multi-use land? An example, we look at a forest and, you know, we see forestry resources there. Of course, that's not like row cropping. We're probably on a 60 to 100-year rotation where you're on an annual rotation. But we see a forest, but we also see trails. So there's a multi-use to that forest. There's an economic use, trails, tourism, as a sorts of thing. There's a water quality aspect to it because, you know, forested land is essentially protected land. What I'm looking at here is and wondering, what are the multi-use opportunities we have? Like, you know, some crops that would improve water quality, not just necessarily row crops. You know, grass, gigantus moranthus, something that is available for biofuel use. I mean, can you talk to ideas you've had about multi-use property rather than it's either going to be economic development or water quality?
Right, right. Well, one probably qualifier on this stuff is that this is land cover. So land use is oftentimes two things, right? You have land cover. So what are you growing, and then how are you managing it? You know, you got your land management practices. So is it tiled? Are you doing no-till? Are you doing, you know, your water and soil conservation basins? So we've got kind of the two pieces. Yes, what you're saying is absolutely in line with the path we're taking, which is to try and explore potentially what many times literature calls ecosystem services, is that there's a stacking of benefits that a landscape or a system provides. And so how we capture that in terms of, you know, that doesn't just provide habitat for waterfowl, but it also, you know, keeps the sediment nutrients from downstream receiving waters, which have to treat that water for urban drinking water or those kind of things. Why we've kind of latched on to a GIS-based rules approach is because we want to move seamlessly between scales. And so the kind of approach you're talking about was done, and that's actually the intent that these are crafted off of, which is a study done by the University of Michigan and a couple of basins in Iowa. But they went and they asked locals, they hand drew a lot of details about, tell us what you'd like to have, tell us what, you know, they captured things like turning radius of combines and things that really when you start to scale out to a regional perspective and to an upper Mississippi River basin perspective perhaps, you're not able to do in a practical way. So it raises a fundamental challenge of if we were going to look for something that provided multiple benefits, how would you accomplish that? Would you ask your economics person to say, go and identify all the practices that would maximize economics and then your water quality max, you know, design a map that would maximize this and then maximize that? We're taking the other approach, which is to say we can create rules for a landscape. Then we can run them through the models, and the models will give us the output. And then we're going to use the public engagement process to capture values, which is to say, I really would, for my watershed, I'd like to have, that's too extreme, I'd like to have some of that and some of that and some of this. And because they're an a la carte build for these scenarios, we can take these and put them together in different combinations so that we can actually create what we're calling a master watershed plan for them. So it's a customized watershed vision for that particular small basin. And then because it's rules-based, we can we can resimulate that for the entire basin and say, if everybody in the basin felt the way the people in Seven Mile Creek do, or Shakopee Creek, what would that look like on water quality at in Lake Pepin or in different check-in points that we're going to designate along the way? So it's a different approach. Yeah, you definitely could take that other approach. It's just hard to get a – you have to have a foundation with which from everyone's working from. So that's why we're looking at the landscapes.
Other questions or comments? Seeing none.
Okay. Just quickly, are you, with this process, able to identify any of the economic benefits of the ecosystem services? Is that something that is part of this process?
Yeah, that's a part of the project scope. The details on that are playing out within this economics working group. So
okay,
as
you.
We talk with Pulaski and others are trying to get figured out what we're going to measure and how we're going to measure it.
All right. Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Jason, for your presentation. I think what we'll do at this point in time is put off our last item. Eric, you okay with that? Okay.
Relieved.
What's that?
I was sat here the whole meeting.
Yeah, you sat here the whole meeting. Wore your green tie, too. You know, it's gone.
He's relieved. He's not worried.
Well, I noticed your green tie. It's a nice green tie. I think what we'll do then is call for adjournment at this time. Thank you all for your participation. A motion to adjourn would be in order.
I move.
There's a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
There is a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries. The meeting is adjourned.